This is Steve Maxer conducting an interview with Mr. Philip Watson on the 23rd of April 2001 at approximately 9:10 Lubbock time. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Watson is in Dallas, Texas. Sir, why don't you begin by telling us when and where you were born and where you grew up?
I was born May the 12th, 1949 in Henderson, Texas, and lived there till I was 10 years old and moved to Dallas, Texas. And that's where I completed high school and then went into the military.
Okay. And when you were growing up in Texas, did you engage in any kind of work or anything?
Yeah, I worked as I had a paper route and worked summer jobs as construction.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did your family do? What did your father and your mother do?
My mother was in banking as a low-end type employee, and my father worked for the state controller's department as an auditor.
Okay. Did you enjoy school as you were growing up? And what subjects, if so, what subjects did you enjoy?
I just took general, whatever courses they had in high school. And, I can say I did enjoy it. I wasn't crazy about it, but I did, by and large, enjoy school, yes.
Did you have plans on continuing once you graduated from high school?
Continuing going to school?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah, I plan on going to college.
And did you have any brothers or sisters?
I had one brother that was 2 years younger than me.
Okay. Let's see. And how about sports? Did you enjoy?
Yeah, I participated in all sports until the latter 2 years of high school, which I worked jobs prior to that. But prior to that, I participated in basketball, football, and baseball until, like I say, my junior and senior in high school. I did not continue to participate. It was pretty difficult, really, to play where I was at Thomas Jefferson High School. I mean, you had to be pretty darn good and dedicated, and I just simply wasn't that good.
Okay. Well, let's see. What year did you graduate high school?
67.
What did you understand in terms of the Vietnam War and what the United States was doing in Southeast Asia when you were graduating from high school?
Well, in my junior year in high school, it was a pretty big topic amongst our age group. We knew it was going on, and we knew it was draft, and it was on TV, and there was a lot of conversation amongst us guys about that. And by the time I was a senior, we were already hearing. In fact, one of the guys I went to high school with, his brother was killed already. So the civics teacher said it was a war to contain communism, and we kind of had heard maybe that wasn't the case, and we were kind of had mixed feelings about it, frankly, and just didn't want to go, get drafted and be over there. That was pretty much the general consensus amongst all of us in my age group. Mm-hmm. And there was always talk about, what are you going to do about it? Most people just were going to go to college and not worry about it, and that was the general consensus. But there was a general good feeling about it. There was not a good feeling about the war.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have these types of discussions, and did you discuss these issues with your parents at all?
Very little. And actually, my parents were of the opinion that there was no discussion to be had. If the government thought that we ought to be over there fighting, then that's what we should be doing, that they had a reason to be there, and we should go along with it. I mean, my parents were very World War II generation, believed the government could be, could do no wrong. And if they wanted to participate or get involved, then we should just go along with it. Mm-hmm. And if it's my turn to go, I needed to go.
Okay. Now, did your father and other relatives who served in the Second World War?
Yeah, my father was served 3.5 years in Europe, and was he was not a combat, but he was very much involved with the air campaign, the bombing and so forth. He flew on B-17s. My mother actually did join the military at the very end of World War II and served a little bit of time. She became a sergeant, I know that. And I had uncles on both sides of the mother and father that participated quite a bit in both, the Japanese part of it and the European campaign. So there was a lot of uncles and stuff that went. My whole family was pretty much involved in World War II.
As you were growing up, did they discuss the war with you and what they did?
Yes, they did. They sure did. They explained that they went and did their duty.
Did that have an impact on you?
Yes, it did to some degree. Even though I had no problem going in the military, but I was forming a pretty much anti-Vietnam opinion going into my senior year. Mm-hmm. And as the senior year progressed, I was even getting more and more anti-Vietnam. I mean, I just didn't think what we were doing over there made any sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was keeping track of it. It's obviously I was going to have a problem at the end of my senior year because it took money to go to college, and that was exactly what I did not have at the time.
Well, what did you think the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam when you were graduating from high school?
I can't say I sat down and actually figured that out when I was a kid at 18. I thought that they probably felt like that there was some kind of a war that needed to be fought. Frankly, I thought I was cynical. I thought that they hadn't been in one in 20 years, and it was time to get into one. That's what kind of the way I looked at it. And there were plenty of people that were pro Vietnam, and there were plenty of people that wanted to go. So, but I just wasn't. I didn't want to get involved with it.
Now, did you live near a college?
SMU was fairly close to my house, but I can't say it had an impact, even though it kind of did. I delivered theses over there my junior year at night to the dorms, and some of the guys over there were talking about how, you know, they were studying hard, saying, you know, we could easily get drafted if we didn't make our grades. And I did talk to some of those SMU students about that, and I could see my term was coming pretty quick if they didn't do something about that war. It didn't look like they were going to. Mm-hmm. There was no end in sight at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you know anybody from, say, your neighborhood who did go to Vietnam and came back or didn't come back?
You know, I did not. No one. I have a large family on both sides of the... Nobody went to Vietnam that I knew, even in the neighborhood, relative or otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I had no one to talk to about it. Mm-hmm. I did run into a guy one time, and he'd been over there like in 65 or 66, and he didn't talk much, but he said, yeah, he'd been to Vietnam and he'd gotten back, but there was nobody really to talk to. Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, was there a junior ROTC at your high school?
There was, and it was very out of favor with the general population student body. Mm-hmm. But it was there, yes.
And you were not in the cadet corps there?
No.
It was junior ROTC. Okay. But in the, I know you, as you said, you didn't sit there and try to sort out or figure out exactly what we were doing, but in the grand scheme of things, did you understand or did you talk about this notion of the domino theory, anti-communism? You know, how did those things
Yes.
factor into your thoughts and discussions?
Now, that was explained to us pretty in-depth by my civics teacher. Mm-hmm. That they did go into that. That was the containment of communism. I remember her saying that, and she talked about the domino theory and those things. We couldn't grasp the concept. I couldn't. That little bitty country completely across the world was where it was just critical that we, you know, take the measures we were taking at the time.
Mm-hmm. So it just wasn't a credible idea to you.
And that's exactly right. It was not credible. Hmm. And I think history proved that out.
Well, and this was in civics.
That's correct.
Did you guys talk about the draft?
Absolutely. You know, you had to go down and register since you turned 18, which is your senior year. Mm-hmm. So throughout the senior year, guys were turning 18 going down and registering. Mm-hmm. And that in itself was a pretty, at least when I registered. Now, I heard other guys say the different, but it was a pretty, you know, you will do this, boy, and type registration, which, again, further galvanized our feelings against the, you know, what we were trying, what the older generation was pushing us around. There became that generation gap or between the people that were making us do this and our parents, i.e. our parents and us. And, you know, here we were all getting, you know, getting our draft cards throughout our senior year.
Mm-hmm. Well, how were you raised in the context of, not in a derogatory or negative sense, but the permissiveness of your family and your household. Were you raised to think that you could do anything you wanted with your life?
Absolutely not. I was taught that, you know, I was raised pretty disciplined, actually.
Okay.
You know, we got up, had to go to school. You didn't bring home halfway decent grades, you were in trouble. Mm-hmm. And then when you had some spare time, you should be, you know, doing something, playing sports or working. If you weren't playing sports, you wouldn't be working.
Mm-hmm.
As far as doing what you could with your life, yeah, it was pretty much that was the situation. You had to go to college. There was no two ways about that. You had to get a college degree. That was a given.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, you were going to have to go down and get a college diploma, and that was pretty much beat into our heads.
Mm-hmm. And how about just the notion of the American dream? You know, you're only limited in what you accomplish in your life by yourself.
That was pretty much preached to us, yes.
Mm-hmm.
American dream was the way to go, and we were told we lived in the best country, and
mm-hmm.
That it didn't come easy, and we had generations ahead of us that paid some serious dues so that I could have as easy as I did. And I was reminded of that pretty often by my grandparents even, and my older aunts and uncles.
Had your grandfather served in World War One or in the Second World War?
No, he didn't. He was actually too old and for one and too young for the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, too old for two and too young for one.
Right.
Okay.
I had a great grandfather, my father's grandfather, who served in the Texas Cavalry and was had a legend about himself, and had some of his letters published and whatnot. So we were. We went way back as far as that goes. On my mother's side, we had tombstones of our great-grandfather or great-great-grandfather, whatever, that served in the Mississippi infantry. And there, there it was, CSA right there on his tombstones for all their family reunions to be seen. So military service went way back.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. And what else factored into your decision eventually to voluntarily enlist?
Well, I mean, I was strictly running from the draft and the Army.
Okay.
I tried to get into the Air Force, and they were full, and there was a long waiting list, and by the time I would have gotten into the Air Force, I would have been drafted into the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down and joined the Navy, and I felt, actually, I had to go to Longview, Texas, and then I had to go to Shreveport, which is no small feat back in 1967 for a kid broke,
Mm-hmm.
And when I finally got a slot in the Navy, I felt like I'd at least gotten away from Vietnam. At least I was going to have to serve in the military, but I wasn't going to have to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you go to a recruiter there in your hometown?
Well, in Dallas, it was completely impossible to get in the military, get in the Air Force or the Navy. It was booked up, and there were 6 months waiting lists. But they did tell us that they had a slot in Longview, Texas, and maybe had a slot in Shreveport, Louisiana, and so. I got on the road and went to find out if those slots did in fact exist, and they
mm-hmm.
did. And I got in by going out of town.
So you could enlist in a different town, even if it wasn't your home of residence.
Yeah, it was wherever the recruiter had a quota.
Okay.
And in this particular situation, I think it was Longview. I can't remember. I went to both Shreveport and Longview, but I think I ended up getting in Longview and finding a slot there.
How'd you get there?
Drove a buddy of mine's car.
Mm-hmm.
I borrowed a friend of mine's car.
That was nice.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
It was a deal, man.
Yeah.
Everybody was scrambling, or at least I was. Cause...
Mm-hmm. When you arrived there and you saw the recruiter, were they eager to accept you? Or?
Yeah, I walked into the Air Force recruiter and he said he's gone to lunch, but we've got a 2 or 3 month waiting list. I walked right next door to the Navy recruiter. And I said, I'd be interested in talking to somebody about joining the Navy. And he said, you have come to the correct place. And he signed me up almost immediately.
Wow. Now, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do in the Navy? And did he discuss options in terms of your MOS or your specialty?
He asked me if I had some mechanical aptitude, which I guess I had some, But no, I didn't have any idea whatsoever I was going to do in the Navy. I had no clue.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the Navy had been never anything I'd ever even considered
mm-hmm.
in my entire life. Of all four branches, I guess the Navy would have been the last one I'd have gone in had I had, a free reign of choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you have to take any kind of exams, aptitude exams or anything like that?
Yeah, they gave me some kind of a mechanical exam, like pictures of a screwdriver and a pair of pliers, and and you're supposed to circle which one was.
Okay.
They were very simple tests.
Okay. And so that day, you basically, you signed up for the Navy.
Yeah, and they asked me questions like, did naked males attract me, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Which I said, they were very stupid questions, and basically I took nothing to get in.
Yeah. Okay. Now, and how long after you actually signed those papers, how long did you have before you actually went to your initial training post?
Now there was some latitude there. Once I signed up, I think the guy told me I could either go almost immediately or I could have a couple of months. There was some latitude, I remember. And I just said, well, let's just go ahead and go on in and get it over with.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. So then I went down to Dallas and did the processing, and, mm-hmm. and I was out that afternoon.
On the same day?
No, I'm sorry. When I did the processing, two or 3 days later, and then I was gone that afternoon.
Wow. What did your mom and dad know that you had gone down to Longview? And
no, they didn't. No, I told them once I'd already signed up, I came in and said, "Hey, by the way, I'm going into the Navy." And at the time, I was going to junior college, but I had run out of money, and it just I was just broke and miserable, and you know, at the end of the semester, I had no more money, so I knew I was going to go, and something was going to happen, so I just went ahead and jumped on it. And when I went back, told them I joined up, and you know, my mother got pretty upset and said she was going to try and get it turned around. I said, "Hey, look, I mean, the draft's going on, there's a war going on, and I'm at risk, and I'm going to do what I got to do here."
Mm-hmm. What'd your dad say?
Well, he, you know, he just resigned himself to the facts and just said, "Okay, whatever you got to do."
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a complete change of attitude by them, though. I mean, by the time that I was over there, my brother, 2 years behind me, they were, after I'd gone through it, they had a complete change of attitude. They thought that the war was a mistake, we should have peace with honor. We shouldn't just pull out immediately. We should just get out of it somehow and save face. But in the meantime, my brother, for sure, was not going. And they took a proactive stance with him.
How so?
Well, first of all, they were going to make sure that there were several things. First, make sure he had money for college,
mm-hmm.
to keep his student deferment going. Secondly, I don't know what they'd have done. I guess there were other ways if you really wanted to do it. I'm mm-hmm. sure there was plenty of ways. You could go to doctors or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But as it turned out, the lottery came out. He got number 365. He pretty much never had to worry about it.
Well, did he? How did he feel about that? Did he want to go in the military?
Absolutely not.
Okay. So he was open to their assistance to avoid
open to my parents' assistance.
Right. To stay in school and whatnot.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay.
And actually, I don't think anybody was. Not that many people were, anti-military. I mean, the mm-hmm. military wasn't such a bad deal. You got to go and, do some things that were kind of fun, I guess, but it was that Vietnam War that mm-hmm. was the problem.
Mm-hmm. Well,
in fact, my parents were, lamented that my brother should have gone in the military, mm-hmm. but they said this Vietnam thing was not going to cut it, particularly after I had been back and been, injured like I was.
Mm-hmm. So what was it, do you think, that changed your parents' minds?
Well, I think my letters home helped a little bit, plus it was just dragging on, and then you had Johnson in the election of 68, I'm sure that had an effect.
His declaration that he was not going to seek re-election?
Well, that, and plus it was getting he was playing politics trying to get Humphrey elected. Nixon came in with a completely different attitude. He had a secret plan. He was going to end the war, and people said, "Okay, let's get the." I just don't think people really thought, that there was something we need to be committed to. I mean, it was dragging on. There was no end in sight. We had guys like Westmoreland that just did not come across as credible. This is, they didn't tell me this, but, I'm sure they had to have gotten. I know this. When I went into the Vietnam in 68,
mm-hmm.
the attitude was one thing, and I didn't talk to my parents for, 9 or 10 months. And when I came back, that complete absence of mm-hmm. seeing them, I could see that their attitudes completely had changed. Now, why, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
They never told me that.
Okay.
But I could see that their attitude about it had completely changed. They were just glad that I was home and alive.
Yeah. Now, what month and what year was it that you went to Longview and enlisted in the Navy?
That was November of 67.
November 67. Do you remember when Westmoreland made his, he came back from Vietnam, made his presentations to Congress and to the American public about the nature of the war, that in his estimate, the light was at the end of the tunnel, the war was almost over?
Was it Westmoreland that said that?
Yes, it was.
I don't remember that exactly. I thought it was Nixon that said the light at the end of the tunnel.
No, sir.
Okay. Well, I'm sure you're right. I can't say as I remember that, but I don't doubt that I saw it because I was pretty much a news watcher and a Time magazine reader.
Okay. I say no in terms of Nixon. He probably did say it as well.
But it was Westmoreland.
But in terms of in 67, it was Westmoreland had come back and said basically, the war's almost over. I don't know if you used that exact.
And that was prior to Tet.
Right, and then Tet hit.
Yeah.
And that of course had a profound effect on the American perception of the war.
Right. And yeah, exactly.
Now, so you in November 67 you enlisted. That same month you went off to the Navy. Where did you go to your initial training?
Great Lakes, Illinois.
Okay.
And that was another source of, just immediate consternation with me. I mean, I was told by my recruiter, no uncertain terms, I would go to San Diego for my training. There's two places to go, San Diego or Great Lakes. Well, San Diego is a nice place to be. Great Lakes in November through February is, I learned the new definition of the word cold because I had lived in Texas all my life, and I could not believe how cold it was up there. And it was a miserable experience. And, you know, I immediately was lied to by my, of course, who knows if he was lying or he didn't have the information. But bottom line was I did not like at all what had happened right immediately. I took a flight to Chicago as opposed to San Diego. And right off the bat, I was, the whole thing was going downhill fast.
Well, did you, after a couple of days or, you know, as you were getting into the Navy, did you then know what your specialty would be?
Oh, no. No, we were strictly in boot camp, and it was a while before we took a battery of tests, and then it was late in my, you know, I think 9 or 11 weeks, I forget how many weeks it was, of training, which is a fairly long time, that they told me where I would be going to school. And I got a pretty darn good technical school out of boot camp. I got to tell you, they being the radio school was a good another 6-7 months of electronics and chat training. And, you know,
wow.
So, I mean, they were going to invest some time in me, no question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you... You went to Great Lakes, did your basic, I mean, your boot camp. What was the most challenging aspect of boot camp for you besides the cold?
The sleep deprivation.
Okay.
That was not really anything else I'd say physically that challenging.
Okay. How about mentally challenging?
No, not really.
And were they still training you on knot tying and that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah, we went through a little bit of that, but not as much as you'd think. There was very little knot tying, actually.
there was
some of that, but that was not stressed heavily at all.
Okay. And what kind of weapons training did you receive?
We got to shoot some .22 single-shot rifles, you know, one day, I think.
That's it?
Yeah.
Okay. What did you spend most of your time doing there at boot camp?
We went in classes, marching and in classroom, and I actually had notebooks. We took notes and... They, you know, explained to us how to look at a different ship from horizon, tell what if it's a destroyer or a cruiser, and they told us some history and they about the Navy, and they explained to us all the rankings and how discipline works, and just basically made us, you know, learn about the uniform, which is a rather bizarre type, unorthodox piece of clothing, if there ever was one, but... they explained the history of it and why it was the way it was. Obviously, we went through some swimming training and some water survival training, which was fairly interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So we did all that.
Okay. And let's see. How did they enforce discipline?
Well, pretty much the old iron fist. I mean, you know, if you didn't do, I mean, I don't know. I never questioned what I should do. I just did it. I mean, I saw other guys get in trouble, and I didn't want to have any part of that. I mean, it looked like to me they could make your life so miserable. They already were making it miserable. They could really, you know, notch it up without any trouble at all. I mean, they could literally send you to the brig, which we heard there were beatings and that sort of thing. I never saw it. I don't even know if it happened, but we heard that it was the case.
Mm-hmm.
But I pretty much knew what they wanted me to do, and I pretty much did it. As far as they didn't have to discipline me much, I went along with the program.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and you know, one thing they could do is, opposed to disciplining you, they could discipline your fellow, you know, boot camp guys, and that was to me even worse.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that a couple of times. They'd say, okay, you come over here and watch this, and they discipline the other guys, and that was the last thing I ever wanted to do, was make my fellow, you know, whatever you call this, you know, suffer because of something I did.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was no problem disciplining me, and or very few of us. And almost none of us had any problems. And I'll tell you, when I was in the boot camp, I was in with a bunch of guys that were just like me. They wanted out of the military, out of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these guys had Ivy League, you know, college training. I mean, there were some educated guys in there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was one of the youngest, but a lot of these guys were from the Northeast or in the East Coast along those. But they were... you know, they've been to college, and these guys are 21, 22, 2 years old, 23, 24.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what kind? When you say that some guys got in trouble, what would they typically get in trouble for?
Fighting. Most cases, that was where the real trouble broke out. Some guys got in trouble because they just could not, you know, get their bunks done right, or they'd leave their lockers open. That was pretty bad thing to do, and some guys just couldn't get it together. I mean, you had all, you know, you had your bell curve in this place, and you had some guys just couldn't adapt.
Mm-hmm.
to any kind of discipline or whatever, and they just simply got moved out of our company, and I don't know what happened to them.
Okay. Well, and what about the makeup of your your boot camp platoon?
I was pretty impressed.
Was it a pretty mixed group?
It was pretty mixed, but again, it was skewed towards guys that had been to college and guys that were pretty smart and pretty. I bet if you had a reunion, you'd find every one of those guys pretty darn successful.
Mm-hmm. What about the ethnic makeup and the religious makeup?
That was interesting as well. That was an education in that regard for me that I can say was very positive. Discrimination and all the civil rights thing was very much at a red hot at that time, and in fact, while I was over there, Martin Luther King was shot, and in Chicago there was huge riots, and we could see outside the compound just neighborhoods burning. We could see the fires, and we were of course kept in inside the naval post, but we knew it was going on, and inside we had several 10 or 11 blacks, African Americans, whatever. They were in our company who were very, just excellent sailors. I mean, they were doing excellent jobs. And they were as good as keeping their uniform together or learning the knots or what all that stuff that you had to do. And I graduated from the largest high school at the time in the state of Texas, mm-hmm. and that was Thomas Jefferson. And we had one African American at that school. Now, 2 years later, it was completely different. But when I got into the military, I was exposed to the African American in a close proximity, and I was frankly quite impressed.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, as I went to school, to technical school, and there again, I experienced something I had not experienced, and that was. Now, I can't say as far as Hispanics or American Indian or anything like that, I had any exposure to, but it was blacks, and that I did get my first really close up, get to know the people.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never had a friend prior to that, and I did get friendly with some of the ones in there. The religious makeup you just mentioned was also very interesting. I was raised a Baptist and went to church regularly throughout my life, and we were told that my mother told me, she said, if Kennedy gets elected, we'll probably have to go to Catholic schools. Catholic churches, and I didn't really know what she was talking about, but bottom line is my parents were not very tolerant of the Catholic beliefs or mm-hmm. the way of doing things. I got into the Navy, and after boot camp, no matter how drunk we went out and got that night, I noticed the Catholics got up the next morning and went to Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And they had just gotten just as drunk as the rest of us and had just as bad hangovers as the rest of us. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, these Catholics, my mother was telling me are such non-Christian people. How come they're getting up and going to church and those Protestants are not? So I was exposed to the Catholic arena, which, I was surprised. I was starting to learn that some of the prejudice stereotypes that I'd been taught really weren't true. And I can say from that regard, I can say that I really did get a good experience.
Okay. How was the treatment in terms of recruits by the instructors? And was there much difference in how they treated different types of recruits?
No, as a matter of fact, there were not. And I could tell you right off the bat, there was some friction, some racial friction at the very beginning between some of the whites and some of the blacks, and it was instigated strictly by the whites. And we had gave us a sit down, and a guy we respected very much. He was a tough white guy. Came in and explained. Says, "We're going to explain something to you." He said, "This is 1967 again." He says, "There is no racial problems within the Navy." He said, "Everybody is the same." He said, "Anybody, conducting themselves in a fashion other than that, you're in big trouble." Well, again, I was pretty much got to follow the rules, and that's what they said do. That's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the blacks themselves were selling themselves. I mean, they were doing good jobs, and hey, look, we were all busy and under a lot of stress, and if this guy helped me, and I can help him, and everything got through this thing a little easier. That was the bottom line. It was not, you had to pretty much throw the prejudices or anything else out the window to get the job done.
Mm-hmm. Was there much racial identification, probably the best way I can put it, the black power fist, that kind of stuff?
Now, not in boot camp and not in training, but in Vietnam and after Vietnam, very much. Now, then things really turned nasty. I mean, in Vietnam, there was a lot of that, and there was a lot of, first of all, there was people killed in Vietnam over racial problems. Mm-hmm. It continued forward. When I was in the hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, one night in the summer of 69, we had a big racial fight. We had, the next morning in the hospital, we had guys that were now in the hospital because of this racial, huge racial fight, and ominously, the head of the black group turned up dead in the city of Memphis about a week later, and the rumor was the Navy killed him, or the CIA, or somebody.
Wow.
Now, that, of course, you know, that's rumor, and probably has no basis, but that's what we heard, and we weren't surprised. I mean, that wouldn't have surprised me in the least, you know, that the Navy found out who caused this problem and did him in. And I know that in Vietnam there was a whole, you know, there's a whole segment of people that said, "Hey, enough of this Vietnam stuff. I'm getting out of here. I'm getting back to the States one way or the other." And there, you know, they were off, deserted or whatever, but they were still in Vietnam, and some of them were coming up dead. I mean, I didn't see this, okay, but it was going on.
Mm-hmm.
We were hearing about it, you know, from the other people that knew about it. They were, you know, at night and so forth, and we were, you know, sitting around.
Mm-hmm.
But the racial thing got pretty severe later on.
And just to make sure I understand you, when you heard that the Navy might have been behind that assassination or that killing, that didn't strike you as just an absolutely ludicrous concept. You actually thought it was credible.
I to this day think it may be credible.
Wow.
Now, let me tell you something. People don't understand that 1969, things were getting a little out of control. I mean, it was, you know, you look back at the demonstrations going on in the streets. I didn't want to be part of that, but I can tell you inside the military, we had a tremendous strain going on in the hospital on the Marine. Now, mostly in the hospital was Marines.
Mm-hmm.
Between the blacks and the whites in the Marine Corps, it was really stressful. And, you know, and like I say, we had that huge fight, and that was mostly Marines, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It just, people were dying. Not just being killed in Vietnam, people were dying in other ways, and racial parts of it was part of that. And there were some drugs going on. People were buying and selling that. They're using it, and you know, there was trouble. There was lots of trouble.
But the drug use you're describing, it was not at boot camp.
Oh no, no, okay. Boot camp was very, very you didn't even have, it was nothing. I mean, boot camp was. Boot camp, there was none of that at all, and we had some freedom that we got. That people got in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Did you encounter racism at boot camp to any significant degree amongst the trainees, your fellow trainees?
No, I can't say I did. Like I say, they had an iron fist about that. We were given a talk, no racial problems, and there weren't any.
Okay.
Again, I think being busy as much as anything else mitigated that.
Yeah. Okay. What did you think, you know, your introduction into the Navy? Did you, at the end of your boot camp, did you think you'd made the right decision? Or?
I felt a little more positive about it at the end of boot camp.
Okay.
I'd say at the end of boot camp, I was probably as positive as any time I was in the Navy about what had happened, what I'd done. I had actually seen, you know, I could see that all these careers were there in the Navy, that there were certain things you could do, and certainly the travel appealed to me. I had never been on a ship, but all of a sudden the idea, the concept of being on a ship, seemed somewhat appealing, even though I'd heard negative things. I'd also heard positive things, and I was pretty upbeat now that going out of boot camp into the Navy, into the next, you know, session of training and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, where did you go when you finished boot camp?
I went back to Great Lakes, Illinois, for I think for 6 or 8 weeks. I can't remember, and then we went from there to Bainbridge, Maryland. And for radio in school and more electronics training.
Were you pleased with that technical specialty that was given you?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting. I got introduced to electronics, which I'd never had any exposure to, and I thought it was pretty darn interesting. And the radios and how they worked, and the Morse code, I could say. And it was classroom. I've always kind of enjoyed a classroom environment. I was doing well. I mean, when I got in training, I think I graduated there were two segments. I graduated top of one of them and second the other, and I was behind in both cases where I got beat out. I was where 4-year college degree guys beat me out. I was had zero college, so I was 18. They were a lot older than me. I felt like I was doing well, and the Navy was acknowledging my doing well, and you know, and I was getting some accolades in that regard, and I felt good about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, on what types of equipment were you taught to send messages of Morse code?
Well, it was just a key, you know, a typewriter. We received it on a typewriter and through headsets, and then we sent it on a list of just a keypad thing. And, as far as other equipment, we were introduced to other types of radio equipment, but it was just a matter of dialing in the frequencies and, you know, safety procedures and that sort of thing.
So it wasn't Morse code on a telegraph transmitter?
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
Oh, telegraph.
Or on a shutter light, one of the lights on
no,
the ship.
No, we didn't do that. I've seen that in movies. No, we didn't do it that way. We did it on a key that, you know, and you punched it out, and mm-hmm. somebody else on the other end picked it up with a typewriter.
So you did have to learn on the transmitter portion, like on a telegraph type instrument, a key that you would tap.
And we were ranked in the classroom as to how fast you were, mm-hmm. How competent you were. You know, the first guy was at the first seat, and the worst guy was at the back seat. You know, and you were, and that was constantly changing.
Interesting.
Depending on how well you were doing, and I was mm-hmm. first seat for almost the entire time. And again, that was, you know, I had no clue why I was good at this. I was as surprised at it as anybody else.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think it had anything to do with intelligence at all, because I think a lot of smarter guys just couldn't hear that stuff and pick it up.
Okay. Wow. Well, what was the most challenging aspect of your electronics and radio training?
You know, they gave us some pretty hard tests occasionally. And, you know, you had to study. It was kind of like, you know, it was kind of like college in a way. And I'd say that, you know, they introduced certain concepts of electricity and radios that you had to sit down and, you know, figure it out, and you never be able to go and get help if you needed it. And when you took the test, you know, it was fairly strenuous. I mean, you know, that was it, just the course itself and how radios, just a typical course, really, mm-hmm. in theory, you know, theory stuff.
Right. Now, the radios on which you were trained, were these all shipboard radios? Were some of them portable? You know, what kind of radios were you trained on?
I was just trained on shipboard radios, and I guess they could have been used outside of a ship, but we were told they were all shipboard radios and that's type of thing. We never got exposed to radios that were on our backs like I carried in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But that was too easy to learn anyway. It wasn't like it was difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't take any training, really. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was, you know, see, most of the guys that did not do get most of the guys in that 83-man classroom mm-hmm. went to a ship. I just happened, me and two or three others just happened to go to Vietnam. And once we got to Vietnam, we're still in communication stations there in pretty safe areas where you were using big, you know, radios and teletypes and that. Well, teletypes more than anything.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much of your training was classified in terms of secure radio transmission and reception, stuff like that?
Well, we were told we were going to get secret, top secret clearances. Now, the training itself was not classified, but we were told, you know, this is going to be how you're going to do it on board. You're going to, you know, open up the booklets and pull out the crypto codes, and you're mm-hmm. going to punch them in and mm-hmm. this type of thing. But we were just told that, you know, and again, we knew we were going to get top secret clearances. And that in itself had quite a bit of prestige mm-hmm. within the Navy.
Mm-hmm. Now, and you were trained on the secure radio systems, or secure transmission and reception, or
well, you know, they were secure once they made them secure, and they weren't secure when I was trained on them.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, you know, you it's a code system. I mean, if you don't have any codes punched in, or if you're not really transmitting anything of any value anyway,
mm-hmm.
and that's the way it was in school,
mm-hmm.
then it didn't really matter. But now, when you start, you know, sending out messages about, you know, ship movements and things like that, when you're going to have that coded, and then all you have to do is just lock in the codes there in the system.
Okay. Now, is this an SOI system?
No, what now?
SOI, the Army has a system where they issue a different code book every day.
Oh, yeah. Okay. We had that. I don't remember what that was called, actually,
okay.
But that was what we had, a code book every day.
Okay.
I believe it was every day. Yeah, I think it was.
Okay. And did you enjoy this aspect of your training?
You know, after for a while, and then it got kind of, yeah, in the beginning I did, and then after a while it kind of I could see that it wasn't going to be that challenging, actually. So I kind of got bored with it. But in the beginning, yeah, I did.
How much of it involved electronics repair?
Very little. We mostly got electronic safety. Now, electronics repair was another MOS, and we just didn't get exposed to that. We knew the communication technicians, the electronics technicians guys were getting trained in that, and that wasn't our job. Our job was if we needed that, you know, needed some help in that regard, we called them. In the meantime, we just tried to make sure that we didn't get ourselves electrocuted. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was electrical equipment, and mm-hmm. so you could get hurt if you didn't use it correctly. Mm-hmm. Or you could get somebody else hurt if you didn't do something correctly. So there was not much of, there was no repair, very little repairs, I remember at all. Mm-hmm. And we got some theory on, you know, how resistance works and diodes and all those things in the classroom, but we never got any hands-on.
Now, how many of your instructors in either boot camp or in your electronics and radio training were Vietnam veterans?
Zero. They might have been on a ship in Vietnam. Nobody was on land that I talked to.
Okay.
Now, when I got into survival school just before going to Vietnam, yeah, there were Vietnam veterans there. That was a relatively short period of time, and that was very esoteric. That was not your typical Navy training.
Where was the survival training?
Little Creek, Virginia.
And let's see, so none of the trainers before survival school really talked to you much about Vietnam? Or
no, there was no talk of Vietnam hardly at all. Wow. We were going to a ship, but they did say several times, we know you guys have joined the Navy to keep them going to Vietnam, but in the meantime, you're going to be on a ship, and here's what you're going to do, and mm-hmm. that type of thing. And
so they knew that some of you were, or was it all of you, that joined the Navy to avoid ground combat?
You know, my guesstimation, and I didn't do a poll, obviously.
Right.
Well, I'm going to say 85% mm-hmm. were there because they were running from the draft. Now, how the Navy normally gets people, I don't know. But mm-hmm. we were in there because Vietnam was hot on everybody's mind. I had something I was going to say about that. But and then when I was in boot camp, mm-hmm. the Pueblo was captured.
Oh, yeah.
And that sent shockwaves right through. In fact, all normal operations for training and our normal stuff stopped, and we immediately were sent to classrooms where some other people came in from outside who were Navy, and they, in a very sober, man-to-man type talk, told us that this was part of the grand scheme by the communists, and this was just another incident of how they're trying to divide and conquer us, and that very much we may be, what you may be doing may change. We may be going to war, and that we just want you guys to know that this is very serious, and they've got one of our ships, and it don't get no more tense than this, and we're going to get it back, and we're going to get our people back, and I just wanted to let you know that this is a surprise to us as well, and you guys may see some serious action here pretty soon. And that was out, you know, that was, of course, non-Vietnam, totally.
Yeah.
That was another type of campaign. And that got our minds off Vietnam and on whatever that might entail.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, this larger part of the Cold War, was that heavily emphasized for you as sailors?
No, the Cold War was mostly what we were being trained for.
Right.
We were going to be dealing with Russians.
Yeah.
We were going to be out there making sure our transmissions didn't get picked up by Russians and the Russian fleet. We were told that when we were in port, we may run into the Russian sailors. We were told to avoid them,
mm-hmm.
and not to cause any trouble. Don't try and trade souvenirs with them. Basically, they were our enemy, and that was who we were going to be dealing with, was the Russians. Vietnam was the armies and the Marines' problem, and they'd take care of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, we were going to make sure our ships and planes and carriers and whatnot were at the peak of readiness in case there was a war between us and Russia. And the Pueblo was just a good beginning for the war between us and Russia.
Yeah. Now, was there much? Did you take that? Okay. Was there much training, or was there any difference in training for communications if you're going to be on board a surface ship versus a submarine?
Submarine was totally different. Mm-hmm. That was another fraternity that was so separated from the surface. It would be hard for me to describe that. The submariners, and the biggest way to get, I even see it in movies where people call them submariners, the biggest way to get in a fight in the Navy was call a submariner a submariner. It was a bizarre, in my opinion, fraternity of people, and I never even considered the concept of being on submarines anything but totally insane. But as I look back on it, if I had it to do all over again, I might go the submarine route. They were a group of guys that were very tight, very, very competent. I felt like that they were probably pretty competent. They obviously were in a very risky, riskier day-to-day than, say, a service guy.
Yeah.
But at the time, the concept of being a submarine, and those guys were going to be in submarines after boot camp, they completely went away. We never saw them again.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, it was, submarines were a completely different deal, and we didn't even get to talk to them. I mean, you'd see them occasionally in places, but they were a very elite, different group of people, to put it mildly.
Now, is that how the Navy viewed them?
And yeah, I think so.
They were elite?
Yeah, well, I think so, yeah. I mean, let's face it, I think they were considered elite. That was my impression.
Interesting. Now,
and they had their own little insignia that went on their, you know, above on their uniform. They made no mistake about it. They were submariners.
Did you ever, were you ever told why they took such offense to be called a submarine versus a submariner?
I had no clue. I thought they were weird, and I thought they just were, and I thought they just further reinforced that they were weird. And, you know, my whole concept was to get away from them and stay away from them, you know.
Uh-huh.
They were some kind of a, you know, bizarre, weird group, and anybody would stay on a submarine for 6 months underneath the polar, you know, Arctic or whatever. Under the, you know, to me, it was a weird person.
Wow. Now, so the communication school, that is electronics, radio, and everything else, for submariners was not the same that you went through?
No, it was. There were guys in our class.
Okay.
But they knew they were going to submarines. They'd already got it lined up. Mm-hmm. There was no question. I mean, you didn't just like one day, hey, I think I'll go in this. They were going to be submariners, and as soon as school was over, they were gone.
Okay.
You know, they were heading out.
Yeah.
And it was like, I think, of an 80-person class, I can't remember, but there were three of them.
Were they treated any differently than the rest of you?
Not in school, but I got a distinct impression that, you know, they were tolerating the lower class, okay, when they ate dinner with us and that sort of thing.
You mean the submariners acted that way?
Yeah. And I can't say, and that was fine with us. Most of us were like, hey, that's just fine. But there was a little bit of a different attitude, I thought, and they were certainly more disciplined, and they seemed to be a little bit more studious.
Mm.
Well, let's face it. I mean, that was you didn't go in. You first of all, you get kicked out of that pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
You had to have an attitude, or the Navy was going to get you out of the program.
Mm-hmm. And did anybody purposefully cause a fight by using the slur?
No, no. Anybody that did it was a mistake. And any time I saw it, including me, you'd say so, submariner, and then boom, they'd get in your face about it, and then you'd say okay, you know, and everything was backed off. And
they'd get in your face.
Well, you know, they were pretty emotional about it.
Wow.
You know, I don't know. I think you have that in all your military. I don't know this, but I think that, you know, certain groups of, let's face it, the submarines guys were special forces.
Mm.
And I think all the special forces have their own eccentricities. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't know.
How about SEALs? Did you guys train with any SEALs?
No,
were any people that were slotted to become SEALs?
In Little Creek, Virginia, what was then called SEALs was underwater demolition.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys had their heads shaved, and everywhere they went, they jogged, and they yelled, you know, they went UDT, UDT, and they were completely off the scale as far as we were concerned. Total weird. And I look
weirder
back
than the Submariners?
Weirder than the Submariners, no
okay.
question. Much weirder than the Submariners. I mean, those guys didn't even wear normal Navy uniforms. Submariners wore naval uniforms, but they had their little badge, okay?
Mm-hmm.
These guys, the UDT guys, were, I mean, they were, and I look back on it then, I wish really I could try to go through that program, but from the strict standpoint of just pure discipline, see if I could have done it. But that was considered to be the ultimate in fatalism. You wanted to die, okay?
You mean if you were UDT?
Yeah.
You had a suicide wish?
That's the way we felt, you know.
Wow.
Of course, I'm one of the, you know, kind of like a hippie that's in the military. You know, I'm like, man, this is too weird for me. You know, give me a beer and you know, and a book to read, because I have no concept as to why anybody would want to do what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. Well, was there anything else is there anything else that stands out in your memory about your training in electronics and radio?
No, I came out of it with a pretty positive feeling. I mean, I was up against guys that were a lot older than me. I felt like, well, 4 years back when you're 18 is quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Guys had a lot of college, and I was competing with them and doing well. And I felt like, hey, you know, Navy's slotted me in something I'm good at that I didn't know I was good at it. And, you know, something's working out here positively. And I was real positive, actually.
Okay. When did you find out that you were going to be sent to Vietnam?
Oh, I knew that was going to be your next question. And as a matter of fact, that was a day I'll never forget as long as I live. There were 83 guys, I think, that were in our company. I think that's the number. I may be wrong about that, but I think it is. They gave us a sales job on why you should volunteer for Vietnam. Now we're talking land duty, not ship duty.
Mm-hmm.
They told us about how you got the extra pay, how you got extra ribbons, how you got et cetera, et cetera, none of which appealed to me. And I joined the Navy to keep me going to Vietnam. And I sure as hell didn't, at this juncture, want to get over there, because I was seeing that you could. The radiomen were sent to Vietnam, and I didn't understand this until I got over there, until I got in school. Three or four volunteered. One of my best friends from Detroit volunteered in Vietnam, and I said, are you crazy? He says, yeah. He says, you know, why not? I said, well, I said, you're nuts. Well, there was four of us, I think, sent to Vietnam, three of which volunteered, and I was the one that did not volunteer, but I got to go. So the day I got the mess, back to your question, day that I found out about that, I literally was in shock.
Hmm.
Quite literally was in shock, because now I'd been in the Navy I was in April, I guess, I'm trying to think. It was like May or June, and I'd been in since November, thinking I'd missed it.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, 7 or 8, 9 months later, I'm going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea, the whole plan had blown apart. And not only that, you know, they were taking 4 out of 83, and three of those had volunteered. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt like that I was going to be dead. I mean, I said, this is a real chance now that everything that I have planned has blown up, and I'm going to get killed. And I was really shook up.
Mm-hmm.
I even considered desertion.
Wow.
I checked into it a little bit.
How so?
There was a publication out called the L.A. Free Press at the time, real radical deal. And inside of it, it had draft counseling and, you know, all this stuff that you could go and get in touch with people if you were feeling the draft. And some of the guys had already done this, and I just read basically found out that if once you'd signed up into the military, there was no getting, they couldn't help you. They could help you before you went in, but once you were in, you know, they could not do anything for you legally.
Mm-hmm.
And in that regard, that's how I researched it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I immediately started asking questions then. I seeked out anybody that I could tell, when you could tell, because you'd see these guys walking around on the base, and they were older guys, higher ranked, and I'd see their Vietnam emblems on their chest. You know, if they'd been, I'd just ask them, hey, bud, I'm fixing to go to Vietnam. Let me ask you a question. I could see what MOS he was, if he was a radioman. And I just immediately started polling people, you know, and saying, hey, you were in Vietnam, okay, you were a radioman, okay, what am I expecting to get into over there? And pretty much everybody was like, hey, man, it won't be so bad at all. It'll be, you know, you'll be in a comp stay over there, you know, pretty hard work, but it's okay. You get to go on R&R, and it was not told to me as being a horrible thing, even going to Vietnam at that point. So, again, my research indicated I had no legal outs, and secondly, what I was getting was not that bad from people that had already been.
Right. But, of course, desertion would have been an illegal out.
Very much. But getting killed is pretty bad, too.
Right.
You have to, you know, as a species, you have to think self-survival, and that's exactly what I was doing.
Right. What, and how long did you think about desertion?
Not very long.
Okay.
I just checked into it enough to find out the door was shut.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what was your overall assessment of the training you'd received when you left your communications center?
Well, I felt like I was going to be pretty qualified to go and do the job that I had to do on board a ship.
Okay.
As far as going to Vietnam, it was, you know, I didn't know what I was into then.
Hmm.
Now, so, you know, I still had, even if I did a year in Vietnam, I was going to go back to the ship, supposedly.
Okay.
And that training would carry forward then after my service in Vietnam, in theory.
Okay.
And it did, actually. Mm. You know, I mean, I went to, I say what training I got. I mean, you know, I continued working as a radio man after I got back to Vietnam.
Okay. Now, although the overall your overall assessment was that the training was decent, what did you think about teletype training, and what did you think about your preparation for Vietnam?
Well, you know, we just had a completely different, totally different world. I mean, I was being trained for the Cold War, for going out into the fleet,
mm-hmm.
using electronic equipment and to some degree, and then we were told teletype was something we were going to learn, but it was not going to be used out there at all, period.
Mm-hmm.
And they told us that was the old days. Teletype's gone away. Well, I'm sorry, Morse code.
Mm-hmm.
Morse code's gone away. And so I'm saying, why are we being trained at this? And we're not going to use it, that
mm-hmm.
type deal, you know. And even though they were stressing it so very much and ranking you in class and that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
But you're not going to be using it. Well, that kind of struck me as kind of a poor concept.
Mm-hmm.
But my training, when I said poor, I think that when the concept, the idea that we were trained on something we weren't going to use,
yeah.
Morse code. And then when we got to training for Vietnam, that was poor.
Okay. What did they emphasize in terms of training for Vietnam?
Not to get captured if you're ever in that situation.
This is your survival training you're talking about.
Okay. Very much was, if you even think about getting captured by the enemy, that is something we're going to teach you. You better not think about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
They did train us in that regard. They taught us about, they exposed us very little to the, but they did expose us to the weapons that were used over there. And, you know, there weren't that many weapons over there. It was all done pretty much the same old stuff. And we were exposed to that to some degree. We were taught a lot of infantry stuff, like map reading and hiding in the bushes and how to make food out of the jungle.
Now, this is the training you received in Virginia. How long
was
that?
Well, it was only about a month. Think, as I remember correctly.
Okay.
All classroom, 1 week in the field.
Okay.
So I'm going to say 3 weeks classroom, 1 week in the field.
Mm-hmm. And what did they, I mean, what did they tell you in terms of what was happening in Vietnam, the things that you might encounter?
We saw films about communism and how it was a bad thing and how Ho Chi Minh was a real slime ball.
Mm-hmm.
And how you know, this was just the beginning, and how it was all taking place, and how the big picture of the deal was this, and how those people were brainwashed, and how poor and stupid they were, and
mm-hmm.
How Americans, you know, well, and you know, to some degree, I guess maybe they were correct. I don't know. There was a lot of propaganda. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. What about culture and society, and how to interact properly with Vietnamese people?
Excellent, excellent. Big part of my that was a big part of what I believed. I mean, what I believed, what I felt. We had some old salts come in, guys. It looked like that they'd been to Vietnam. They were older guys. And it was very interesting. They told us that over there in Vietnam, we would find boys, you know, guys, walking around holding hands, and for that not to be looked upon anything that in their culture. That was what they did. Two boys that were friends or just buddies would hold hands walking down the street. Well, you know, this is a very different concept for us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we're saying, okay, all right, well. Then they told us, you know, don't be surprised, of which all this, by the way, turned out to be immediately true.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be surprised if, you know, you see a man or a woman just urinate right there in public. And we're going like, you've got to be kidding us, right? And they said, no, we're very serious. That, they don't see a problem with that at all. Well, immediately over there, we see men and women, you know, urinating in public.
Mm-hmm.
But we're getting this, we got all this ahead of time, and we're like, say again? I mean, these guys are walking around holding hands, and they're urinating in public, and we're defending these guys? I mean, anyway, the bottom line was it was a very interesting introduction in my young life of mm-hmm. other cultures, and frankly, I think I benefited from learning it. And the Navy was telling us there was nothing wrong with it. You know, this is just the way they live. Also, they taught us that smiling in times of adversity was bad. Well, that didn't work out too well sometimes in Vietnam. I mean, you know, you just had a booby trap go off, and you go over to see some Vietnamese, they're all smiling. Well, you know, what's the damn funny, bud? We're having this culture clash, you know. It's not working out real well. But again, they told us up front about this. And it just wasn't something an 18 or 19 year old guy, or in my case anyway, grasped right away. Mm-hmm. You know, but the Navy was telling us these cultural problems, and they told us some others. I just can't think of them right now. But you know, they said you're going to get over there and you're going to find the Vietnamese people quite a bit different than what you've experienced, and they were not incorrect in that regard.
Okay.
They told us about it, and they were, you know,
mm-hmm.
And Vietnam was a different place.
Yes, sir. And what about your survival training, the escape and evasion, that kind of stuff?
One of the most intense things I've ever been through in my entire, when you go without eating for 6 days, you know, I mean, and you're on the run, and they literally beat us up. I mean, I came home with two black eyes. They put us in those little boxes in the ground and
mm-hmm.
put the cover. You know, that was, and going without water that long period was by far the most memorable thing I've got. Everybody's lips turned black. It was and then they did a good job. I have to say they did a good job. They completely convinced me that we were not going to be on an airplane the next day. I mean, I said, well, you know, they've told us, and we were, as it turns out, but they had in my mind that we had been selected out as a group of people to be killed by the military, and this was all top secret. I'd never see my parents again. And when, in fact, the next day we were on an airplane and it was over with, I was so shocked, because it was a very brutal type of training. And, you know, I look back on it and, hey, now they were doing exactly what they should have been doing, because I almost got captured. And I never gave one moment's thought to being captured. I was not going to be captured.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point, literally, where I was going to die before I got captured. And that's exactly what the situation I got myself into. And that's exactly what the problem may have saved me. Who knows?
When you say you would die before being captured, you mean suicide?
Well, in a way, I was going to. The game plan, actually, the day I got hit was I was without my rifle. And I was lying there bleeding very badly, and I was injured pretty badly. And there was a squad. I could hear them shooting because I could tell the sound of an AK-47, and I could tell that they were over there very close to me. And what I was going to do was I picked up a stick and a rock, and I was going to ambush the closest guy, because they couldn't see me. I was hitting pretty good in the grass. I was going to ambush the first guy and get his gun
mm-hmm.
and turn it on the other ones, and I just knew that you know, that would be the end of it, but that was how I was going to that was my game plan at the very second, because, you know, it literally came down, you can die various ways, and being bayoneted to death was something that I wanted to not do, and I just, the idea of being bayoneted to death compared to being shot, you'd be surprised how that reacts in your mind at that moment. You know, I mean, when you're hurt already and you're very badly wounded, the idea of getting it over with in a hurry was much more appealing than being bayoneted to death.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I'll say suicide, I mean, it wasn't a suicide, but yeah, I guess you could say that was suicide. I just want to end it quickly.
Mm-hmm. And when you
and the idea of appealing to a squad of enemy soldiers as like with my hands raised was not an option.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I picked up in training, I guess.
Well, you were going through training, and before, did you ever see coverage about American POWs and some of the footage that eventually was released of captured Americans in Vietnam?
We were, yes. I think we were, as a matter of fact. Yeah, they were treated terribly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we saw them in their white deals being paraded through town. And,
right.
And then pictures of them later, you know, sitting in a bunk someplace, obviously very miserable.
Right. But they were alive.
That's true. That's true. They were alive. Yeah. They weren't, and the ones I saw anyway were not very badly injured. You got to remember, at the time I was making this decision, I was bleeding from every point in my body.
Okay.
And I was, I could tell too that the only reason I wasn't in extreme pain was this numbness that was going to go away, and I was going to be in extreme pain.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy I just been with was dead. So, and I was pretty much in a very much a state of trauma that I felt like I was going to die pretty soon anyway if I didn't get medical help.
Okay.
But you're right. That's a good point.
Now, just out of curiosity, during training in boot camp in particular, one important event in particular, Tet 68, did you hear much about that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact.
How was it covered in your boot camp?
Oh, boot camp, no, it wasn't covered, actually.
Okay.
I don't remember anything about Tet and boot camp. The Tet I heard about was once we got to survival school, counterinsurgency school. Mm-hmm. We had basically missed it, but it, you know, it just happened, and boy, things were really hot over there now. Mm-hmm. We were going into what we thought was a light at the end of the tunnel, like you said, or if mm-hmm. we thought that the thing was winding down. Mm-hmm. Now we were going to something that was not only not winding down, it was bad news. We were getting into it big time. Mm-hmm. The war was very much ongoing, and we could expect to be involved, and that there was not going to be any, didn't look like to us, any end of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Once we got to Vietnam, the guys that had been through Tet, mm-hmm. which I'd missed it, you know, I had a little bit of a more of a, oh, you know, they had an old story to tell that we didn't have. You know, they were there during Tet, and during Tet this, during Tet that. You know, we're back during Tet. Remember back during Tet, Fred?
Yeah.
You know, and we were kind of like, oh, gosh, you know, we're not really as good as you guys because we didn't go through Tet.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you received your orders that you would be going to Vietnam, were you told what position and how you'd be serving in Vietnam?
Yeah, we were told we'd probably go to a communication station, and we would just do teletypes.
Okay.
And be pretty much an office job.
Okay.
Now, there was the riverboat option.
Right. Oh, it was an option? You could choose it?
No.
Oh.
It was an option for the Navy.
Oh, okay.
And, that would be a bad news deal if you go on one of those things. It could be. But then again, some guys liked it. And, you know, if you had an inclination in that regard, you might want to go try it out. But that was something that everybody was pretty much, let's not do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you, when you finally finished your survival training and you got on that plane to go over to Vietnam, did you feel like you were prepared?
Prepared? No, I can't say that I really felt prepared. No, at this point, I felt like that whatever I had experienced as far as training, that was going to be so small compared to what I was going to get into in some way, form, or fashion, that I really didn't think along those lines.
Yeah.
I wasn't prepared to go to Vietnam.
Okay. Do you think you ever would have been prepared?
I don't know.
Was there anything else the Navy could have done to prepare you?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it was a philosophical bent. I mean, I thought the war in Vietnam was wrong, and here I was going my way, and mm-hmm. I didn't have any... what's the word? You know, I just didn't have a philosophical positiveness about this.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to try and go there, do my time, and get the hell out of there, and I just didn't see that I was going to be doing any good by being over there, and I just didn't see any good out of the situation.
Yeah. Okay. And this will end the interview with Mr. Watson on April 23rd. This is Steve Maxer continuing the interview with Mr. Philip Watson on the 24th of April 2001 at approximately 8:35 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Watson is in Dallas, Texas. Sir, why don't you go ahead and describe the reaction of your parents when they learned that you were going to Vietnam?
Well, I mean, I got my orders when I was in the latter part of the radioman school, and I just went to the phone and called them and told them I was going to Vietnam, and, you know, my parents were, like, in shock, and, you know, I explained to them it was going to be land duty. It was not going to be on a ship. And they were just like, oh, man, this is getting bad. You know, so that was all they did. I mean, all they could do. And then, of course, I got to go on leave before I went, got to see them and everything. So and it was just, you know, a continuum of bad news, basically.
Mm-hmm. Now, at this point, had you sensed at all that your parents' opinion of the war was changing?
No, not at all.
Okay.
They And I did you know, a couple of times, my father then, he was in World War II, and the guys he worked with in World War II, and I remember him one time hearing him over with a conversation with some other guys going, you know, Philip's going to Vietnam, and I remember several of them saying, well, you know, I have friends that went over there and sat at a desk the whole time. It may not be such a bad deal, and my dad was rationalizing in that regard, and so I remember him doing that once, literally overheard the conversation. So, you know, he was giving it some thought, and maybe he was thinking it wasn't going to be so bad, that type of deal. But he told me flat out when I left. He said, "Philip, you're going to be it's going to be tough over there. I'm going to just tell you right now. He
mm-hmm.
says, just you know, it's going to be tough."
Mm-hmm. Was he right?
Yeah, he was right. Well, you know, and it could have been tougher, but mm-hmm. it was tough enough.
Right. How about your mom?
She was just like, you know, I don't know. I don't really know what she felt about it. She didn't like it, but
yeah.
she didn't intone to me.
Okay.
Her thoughts or whatever.
She's kind of stoic about it.
Stoic, yeah, I guess that'd be a good way of saying it.
Okay. All right, and why don't you go ahead and describe the trip over? What was that
well,
like?
Trip over was a well, it was kind of a process. I mean, I first went to home for leave for 30 days, and that was nice, you know. And then I had 30 days off, and then I was sent to Little Creek, which I did my, I think, and I thought about it yesterday. I think it was 3 or 4 weeks. I can't remember. But anyway, and from there I had 5 days off, which is a lot of time because they gave me some 5 days to go from the East Coast to West Coast. So I literally had another 5 days home after the training, and I'd got a taste of the toughness, if you will, of in the training. I knew that I was getting ready to do something. So that 5 days was real important to me. Then I made it to California, and immediately got on a flight from out of San Francisco, I believe it was, and it was a long arduous flight. I mean, it was 24 hours on the plane, and we got 2 stops, one in Japan. It was a Flying Tiger Airlines civilian aircraft, and it was just a long time on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we got to Vietnam, I remember we stopped off in Japan. It was a terrible place. It was stunk. It was horrible. And I remember the guys that were demoralized, and we got off to go to the restroom and whatnot. We didn't stay very long. We stopped in Guam, and again, we got off. It was a bad place. It smelled bad. We got off just to stretch our legs and go to the restroom. We got back on. We flew into Vietnam that night. At night, I literally was afraid to look out the window, thinking I'd get shot, and I could see fires burning below. In the night, you know, I could just see these fires down below burning, and it just looked ominous. It looked surreal. It looked like Apocalypse Now. You know, I mean, it was just, and of course, it wasn't that way once we landed. It was just a busy airport, really.
Mm-hmm. And what were your first impressions when you got off the aircraft?
I think the smell of diesel fuel, the sound of a military aircraft was quite intense. You could just hear helicopters all the time. You could hear jet engines revving up. You
mm-hmm.
could hear the sound of diesel trucks. The colors were all drab. It was dirty. There was no civilian life. I mean, it was all a military operation. It was just devoid of any frailty.
Mm-hmm. And when you got off the aircraft, what happened? What'd you do?
We got on, I think we got on like deuce and a half, you know, to bobtail trucks, and got in the back of those, and were just transported over to a base,
mm-hmm.
to Camp Denshaw, actually, I think it was. And we were assigned bunks that night.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do for the next few days?
The next 3 days, I can tell you exactly what we did. We got extremely drunk every opportunity we could. And what we did was went to class during the day, and tried to teach us, well, you know, they instructed us that we were going to be, now everybody was in the Navy, but we were going to all be going completely different ways. I was going to be a readyman, other guys were going to be, you know, who knows, whatever. But they told us some more about the culture, what was going on. We had an admiral come and tell us how many had been killed, how many we killed that way. 234 yesterday morning, we killed another 14 this morning. I remember using the numbers like that. Then half the deal was threatening us if we used our smoke pot or used any kind of drugs. That was half of the orientation, was threatening us about the use of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no intentions of using any drugs. You know, I mean, I didn't feel like they were, again, I thought they were just preaching the wrong sermon. Anyway, they told us more, again, just that type of deal. We'd, you know, go to lunch, come back, and then every night everybody would just go and just go to the, you know, club and just drink. And then the last hour of the third day, the chief master at arms, who's the police, okay, he comes in and says, okay, I want to talk to you guys about, you know, the fact that you might be wanting to smoke some pot, use some drugs over here. And everybody just moaned because we'd heard that so many times. Now, here's the police officer, the chief master at arms, okay, and then you know what he says? He says, well, I just want to let you know that we caught some guys with some pot down here at so-and-so, and he named some little ville. And he goes, we caught them last night, and that stuff was not any good at all. It was just terrible. And I swear he said that. And this
wow.
is, at the end of the 3 days, the speech by the guy that's the cop, and he jokes about smoking pot himself. Now, it was surreal. It was, and nobody's going to believe that happened, and it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that was the first 3 days of the orientation.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got assigned to where we were going to go, and that was it. It went pretty fast.
Now, and what month and year was this that you arrived in Vietnam?
That was September 15th through September 18th of 1968.
1968.
Yeah.
Now, how did they tell you in terms of the drug use policy and the prosecution policy that you'd be tested your analysis at all?
No, there was no that, none of that. Interestingly, no, there was none of that at that time. Like, they could have done that so easily had there been that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I never heard about a drug test until you know, 15 years ago or something, or 20 years ago, whatever. It was certainly not the situation in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
the drug testing.
Yeah, not yet. Okay.
No, not at all.
Okay. And in terms of the culture and the other aspects of learning about Vietnamese life and Vietnam itself, how much do you remember from that briefing, and was there anything new that you hadn't heard yet?
No, not in that 3 days, no. There really was not. I mean, I can't remember anything that there was.
Okay, good enough. And after your initial processing into country, what did you feel again like you had been aptly briefed so that you could do your job? Or?
No, I immediately got sent to riverboat
and
a place called Lateridge, and I went in there, and it was another surreal experience. We went in there, and it was a small office right there on the river, and we went in, and an officer came in and said, and there was two of us, just happened to be two of us, a guy, me and another guy, and he was more higher ranked than I was. I think he was a second class. Of course, I was E3. And he said, and this officer said, okay, you're going to be on the river. He said, we've been experiencing, and I can't remember the number. I've tried to think about this. It was either 10 or 20%. I believe it was 20% casualties. He said, over the last 6 months, we've experienced 20% casualties. I'm pretty sure it was 20%. He said, so therefore, you will be wearing your helmet and flak jacket at all times. He said, even though it's hot, he said, you keep it on. He said, we have two boats available. Each of you will be assigned to one of the two boats. One of them is a very old boat. One of them is a very new boat. The living conditions on the old boat is going to be quite challenging. He said, but the old boat and the new boat is going to be one of the best, state-of-the-art. And so I knew I was going to get the old boat. However, the guy I was standing there with said, I'd like to take the old boat. And I was like in shock, and so was the officer. And he said, well, why? And he said, I just would like that, if you don't mind, if I can have the request. And the guy said, well, sure, if that's what you want. You know, because they were going to give the new boat this guy. So as we were walking out to the pier to get on our boat, you know, the guy said, what'd you do that for? And he goes, well, I'm going to write a book about Vietnam, and I want to make sure that I get experience. I want to pick up as many experiences as possible. And I said, you got to be kidding. And he said, no, that's true. And so he got the new old boat, and I got the new one for that reason.
Hmm.
Now, while we were there in that room, though, being briefed by this one officer, there was a guy that had a military career guy, and I'm going to guess his rank was, you know, high enlisted, maybe a chief petty officer or something, that went nuts and started yelling, screaming, banging against the walls, and he was having a conversation with somebody else, and they called the shore patrol and picked the guy up. And that was right there while we were standing there being briefed about going on our boats. I could see this place was not going to be a lot of fun.
And what was your first impression of the unit in terms of morale and whatnot?
You know, it wasn't that bad at first. I mean, really, the guys were, interestingly, a lot of guys, and I did too, I got caught up in it. I mean, you had a job to do. People were relying on you.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous teamwork. You need to do your part, or you're going to let somebody down or get somebody killed. And so as a consequence, you value, you know, your own worth at that point, really. You made all your political beliefs really kind of had to take, you know, go away because you just had to survive. And it was a tough job, and people needed to work together. And by and large, the morale was pretty good, I mean, at that point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how many people, you said this is a river supply boat, is that correct?
Right.
What size boat is that, and how many people served on it?
There was 12 people on it, and that could vary. And also, I was on one of the newer ones, so there was 12. I think there was 13 on it, actually. And let's see, what was the question? That's how many people?
What size is this?
You know, I don't know how many feet it was. And actually, I looked up on the Internet the other day, or not mm-hmm. the other day, a year ago or something, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of information about these YFU ski-lack boats. And I don't remember exactly how many feet it was. I'm not a boat person. I don't own boats, and I don't sail or anything, so I couldn't tell you off the bat. I'm going to guess it was 50 feet long,
mm-hmm.
and it had a big front. You know, it looked like one of those ones that carry supplies, and back in the back you had your living quarters and your place to steer the thing, and up front was just a big cargo area.
Mm-hmm.
It was like those things that landed at Normandy, and you see in pictures, only instead of just people, they had boxes up front, and it was just bigger.
Okay. And what kind of weapons systems were on board for
ours had
protection?
I believe ours was the biggest gun on ours was a 50 caliber, but some of them had what they called 20 millimeter guns, which were a twin barreled kind of, I don't know, just shoots one barrel at a time, but they go back and forth as they shoot. Now that we didn't have one of those; those were envied. I mean, those were good firepower, but we didn't. We had a 50 caliber, couple of M60 machine guns, and everybody else had an M16. We had an M79 grenade launcher. Somebody was going to use it if we ever got into it, but I never did.
Mm-hmm. But you had your own personal M16?
Right.
Had you used the M16 prior to this?
I had fired in training just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I had been pretty proficient with guns as a kid. I did a lot of hunting with parents and stuff, and I shot a large number of 22s and other shotguns and rifles and things like that. So I was pretty proficient quickly with it. I didn't like the M16, but I could use it, and I did study it and take it apart and keep it in good shape. I don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I shot it a lot more when I got to the Southwind, but in the riverboats I never fired it once.
You never fired it once in the riverboat?
Never did.
Did you ever fire any weapons on the riverboat?
Never did.
Wow. Now,
We actually, we were just mostly worried about mines.
Okay.
They took sniper fire here and there, we heard, but I was only on them 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. No, well, where is Port Litteridge?
It was in Da Nang, but it was outside a little bit, and I don't remember exactly, but I looked it up on the internet recently, and they spelled it Lighteridge, Lighteridge, and I'm almost positive it was LIT, and not a G, but not a GH, but,
okay.
And again, we're going back, but
mm-hmm.
It was there in Da Nang, pretty close, it was on the Da Nang River,
mm-hmm.
But it wasn't right in on the river right where the White Elephant was located. It was in what they call, I think, the deep water port area. And I tell you the truth, I just never consulted a map of that area. And
I don't
know, but it was right in Da Nang.
Okay.
Or close to it.
And most of your river activity was on the Da Nang River?
That's right.
Okay. And let's see, what was your, what were your duties?
I came in right out of radioman school, and I thought I was going to be working the radio, and I was told in no uncertain terms that I was not going to be sitting around working any radio, because that was considered to be kind of a comfy job, that I'd be out there just doing whatever I need to do, a deckhand, if you will, just doing whatever manual labor needs to be done on that boat. And the radio would be, conducted by somebody with a little higher rank. So, and that was pretty much the case. Not everybody went to school out of the boot camp. Most guys just went to the fleet and did some kind of a what they call deck ape type job, and managed maybe to get some schooling later on or whatever. And I was somewhat fortunate. I'd gone to school right out of boot camp, and here I was, and as a radioman. And they said, if you think you're just going to walk in out of radio school and start working as radio, and while we sit down here and do all the manual work, you're crazy. And that was true. I didn't get to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I meant to ask you, in your training, did you receive any kind of improvised radio training, that is, field improvisation? If something happens to your radio, how to configure a system so that you can still communicate, that kind of stuff?
No, I didn't get anything. If I did, I don't remember it. Now, and the radio we used in Vietnam was what they call a PRC-25, which is the same thing that the Army and the Marines and everybody else used. Now, we had radios on board. They were just boxes. They were all different. I mean, there might have been four radios. They were all different. What we used each one for was maybe for more power or for different frequencies, or if one was not, you let one rest while the other one. The only thing we were told was if we were going to get captured, we had to destroy the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And that came back. I was talking to people the other day on this plane that went down in China, and I said, those guys. I said, I don't understand what's going on, because when I was in the service, we had a real serious training on how to destroy the equipment.
Mm.
And I thought, surely they've got that to this day, but apparently they did. But, yeah, we were taught to destroy it. They had thermal blankets, and we could just unwrap those and lay it on top of the radio, pull the plug, and it was just going to, melt everything.
Wow.
But as far as configuring it to use it anyway, somebody might have known that, but they didn't teach it to me.
Okay. And so you said you only spent a couple of weeks on the river, but...
One day all of a sudden the chief comes over and says, Watson, you've been pulled over to the White Elephant. And gave me some basic instructions how to get there, and I packed up and left.
What did you think of your couple of weeks on board that boat?
I was glad to get off of it, real glad to get off of it.
Well,
we had a sister boat was hit a mine, a radio, and a guy named Worrell, W-O-R-R-E-L-L, from Georgia, was killed. A guy that was, another fresh radioman out of school. Now he went to Carnota, and I went to Bainbridge. But he, this guy was killed. You know,
mm-hmm.
another radioman just like me could happen. You know, and he's just glad to get off of him. It's a very dangerous duty.
Mm-hmm. And while you were serving on the boats, did the boat ever make contact? Anybody ever ambush or try to?
Yeah, we took sniper fire, I guess. And I think the bullet. I think so. We were shot at a couple times. They said, but nothing major.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing where we. No air support was called in. And
no one got hit.
No, nobody got hit. No.
Okay. And did you actually avoid mines by detecting them, seeing them?
Yeah, we threw concussion grenades out, which were supposed to blow up the mine before we could ever get to it. Now, that's one thing. That's the only thing I know of that we did.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they had people sweeping those rivers ahead of us. I don't know.
Mm. Okay.
We threw out concussion grenades, which were supposed to set the mine off ahead of time. So we did that.
Did you ever get any secondary explosions from mines?
No, never did.
About how frequently would they throw out concussion grenades?
Pretty often. I mean, I'd say they had an X number per watch, and I'm trying to remember how many that was, but it was probably about, three or four an hour.
Wow.
Two or three, somewhere near it.
Okay.
Well, I mean,
how fast would the supply boat typically move upriver?
I think they said 12 knots or something.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty slow, really.
Yeah.
But then they moved, but mm-hmm. they just weren't speed.
Right. But and at the same time, you're traveling at a speed where three or four an hour, you're not going to hit necessarily every mine with a concussion grenade.
That's true. Yeah.
Did they use concussion grenades when you were? Well, what did you do at night? Did you stay out? Did you come back?
Well, you had watch, yeah.
Okay.
Stayed out, watch, and stay up in the. You just stayed on lookout if you could, or you slept. If you didn't have watch, and then if you slept, you were awakened, and take your post up there at the front where the guy was driving the boat.
Mm-hmm. But at nighttime,
most of the time we were in someplace at night.
Okay.
You know, we came in and got, and we didn't just cruise up and down at night. I mean, it was a daytime operation.
Okay.
You know, we'd pull in someplace at night, out on the river. Now, if you were going down to South Wind or whatever, you pulled out, you didn't hang around the harbor and listen to Da Nang except mm-hmm. at night. Now, you'd go out on the ocean in 20 miles and sit out there.
Mm. Now, and when you did that, did they use concussion grenades during that?
No.
Okay.
And if you traveled up and down the coast, mm-hmm. you didn't use concussion grenades. Because you were out far enough, we didn't really have to worry about it. You was out in the ocean.
Okay.
The river itself was where the danger was, and you didn't go up and down the river at night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you traveled up down the coast at night.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you travel all night long, mm-hmm. but not during the river.
Mm-hmm. What kind of supplies typically did you guys shuttle around? Was it just a whole mixture of stuff?
Yeah, just a mix of, and it was in crates, so I don't know, but I think it was a little bit of everything. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I guess everything. And it was in crates, and I really don't know. The forklifts would come in and pick it up and take it off, and it was labeled in some kind of supply labeling that I never really picked up on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good enough. While you were on the boats, the first time you guys received any kind of fire, sniper fire, whatever, what went through your mind?
I didn't actually know we were even getting it.
Oh.
I'm trying to remember. We got shot at, I was told, and, we got hit. I think one time we supposedly got hit, and some guy pointed it out, but I never really, it never was. We were always on what they call general quarters, where we had flak jackets on, our helmets, and we were ready to go, unless you were out doing some kind of job. And so, I don't even think anybody returned fire when I was on it.
So. Okay. So, was there anything else particularly memorable about your time on the supply boat?
No, not at all. I mean, we went up and down the river. I was scared. I remember one time they came out with some glossy 8x10 pictures, photos of our boat on the river. And I remember saying, they said, would you like to buy one? And I said, where'd those come from? I said, well, it was taken from some kind of aircraft or a helicopter or something. It was down low. And I never knew that was even when that was done. I mean, it was just kind of a bizarre deal. And the old man that ran the chief that ran it, he looked grandfatherly. I he was unfriendly. Everybody on the boat was unfriendly. And I think that's because I was what they call a new guy. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't a part of the team, really. I was just kind of a, hey, do this, Watson, hey, do that. You know, you're relieved. Get up, go do that. I wasn't a part of the camaraderie at that point. It was just I felt like a hostile group of people, and I never made friends with them, so.
Hmm. Now, were you the lowest ranking sailor on the board?
Yeah, very much so. Well, I think there might have been another E3 or two, but yeah, I was the lowest ranking. I had no skills for the boat either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, until you can make a contribution, you know, until you pick up the skills to make a contribution towards the whole thing, you really, and I never even got to that point. So.
Mm-hmm. And
I never even worked a radio on the boat.
Did they train you? Or did you?
No.
Kind of work you do?
I just stood watch and mm-hmm. watched the other guys, and then went out and I think I did some painting, and then did some chipping of paint.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, you know, just manual labor there on the boat.
Yeah.
And then they had guys on there that were really good. I mean, they had a guy that was in the machinist mate room, which I only saw every now and then when the door opened, and he obviously was very good, and they thought a lot of him. And he was a quiet guy, but apparently he was a very good technician. They had, and I always kind of envied him in a way, and, you know, they had an animal, a dog on board, small dog. You know, but I just was not a part of it. I was ostracized, I felt like, and I was glad to get off of it.
Yeah. And when you say they had a dog on board, this was just like a mascot?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. It was a puppy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember I don't know if he's a mascot. I can't say, but he was just a dog. I remember they'd feed him and so forth. He just ran around the boat.
What would you guys do for recreation?
I would read. They would play, you know, some guys play cards, some guys read. There was listen to music, listen to tapes on radios, that type of thing.
Did you have a radio yourself?
Not at that time. I got one later.
Yeah.
The other guys did have them, though.
Did you listen? What kind of radio stations did you listen to?
Well, you know, I had that Armed Forces Vietnam Network, which was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And listen to that. A lot of, you know, most of it was, I think, was cassettes. I think people just had a lot of Jimi Hendrix tapes, and, you know, that old rock and roll, old-time Cream and the psychedelic stuff and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And that was mostly what we listened to. I mean, some people listened to country and western, but most of it was rock and roll.
Did anybody ever tune into Hanoi Hannah?
Yeah, and it was kind of considered to be frowned upon. I didn't see that on the riverboat. I saw that in Da Nang.
Okay.
And it was kind of considered to be frowned upon, but then, you know, some people would do it as a laugh. Now, it came in on Sunday night, as I remember, and some guys would turn it, and what they would do is they'd start out with some really good music, and the Hanoi Hannah or whatever, and then you'd get to listening to it, and then they'd stop and start in with the propaganda. And I never really actually sat and listened to it, but I talked to other people that said they did, and it wasn't very good. And, you know, it was pretty much it wasn't a very good selling tool that they were using to make any kind of swaying of opinion from us.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting. They started out with good music to get your attention.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And were there any underground type of radio stations that you ever heard of or listened to?
Not in Vietnam that I heard of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, when you left the boat and you went to the, as you put it, the White Elephant, that's the headquarters in Da Nang?
Well, it was a communication station, and it was where the number one Navy guy had his headquarters.
Okay.
It was an old French hotel, and why they called it White Elephant, I don't know, but it was an old French hotel, is my understanding. You know, a high quality, a five-star, if you will, at one time.
Mm-hmm.
in downtown Da Nang, we had to go across the river to get to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was where the main admiral was, and where the highest, most sophisticated equipment was, and, as far as communications. And I don't know what else was in there, but it was heavily guarded, surrounded by on top and all around by the Marines. And so just to work in there, I had to punch in a code just to walk in the door, which I thought was pretty ridiculous, but you know, that's where I worked, and it was 12 hours on, 12 hours off, 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I was pretty low ranking. Started out the lowest job on the deal, and
mm-hmm. And this is basically you were sending and receiving messages via teletypes.
Yeah, and there were numerous teletype machines. Plus, we had a a section in there that had a voice communication, and I never did work that. I just could hear them inside there. But, yeah, we were mostly coming in with teletypes. And then every now and then a bell would go off, which meant a flash was coming in, which is an urgent message, and there were different procedures for that. We had different colored paper for the type of classification of the message, and you know, white paper was unclassified, green paper was confidential, yellow paper was secret, pink or red paper was top secret, and we saw mostly yellow, I mean, white and green, some yellow and red, but not much. And you know, these messages come through. Now, you know, those were interesting because they gave us an insight. First of all, it's where we first found out about Vietnamization on those messages. That was, you know, secret, but we were learning that the government did plan on turning this whole thing over to the Vietnamese. And boy, we got all excited about that.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, so we, in fact, I remember a guy came in and said, "Hey, Watson, look at this. Man, they're talking about getting us out of here." And I read it, and I said, "What does this mean?" He said, "Well, they're going to turn it over to the gooks, you know. They're going to turn it over to the gooks. We can get out of here." Of course, that that was our interpretation. We thought we were going to leave next week. And we saw messages come in, too, that I remember reading that were pretty, they were talking about interrogations. I mean, they were had. The message was that they were interrogating this prisoner, and he was exhausted and passed out, and the person interrogating him was a Vietnamese, considered excellent at getting information. Who knows what they were doing to this guy. And that was coming in, and we were reading this stuff, you know. We were reading messages saying that we were very much over in Laos and Cambodia, you know, stuff that they were saying that was not the case over in the general media.
Right.
And the government knows. We were seeing the truth, whereas the government was telling something else totally. You know.
What did you think about that?
Well, I was pissed off about it. You know, the government was lying. We knew it. I mean, all of a sudden, you know, my attitude is changed, being changed. You know, and what are you going to do? You know,
did you ever consider that? Well, because sometimes the government has to lie.
Oh, sure, absolutely. I mean, there's no question about that. We knew that. I mean, you know, I vacillated back and forth between what was the right thing to do. You can't fight a war and expect to win and be truthful up front. So, yeah, I mean, sure I did.
Okay. Now, I meant to ask you earlier, when was your first interaction with the Vietnamese people?
Let's see now. Oh, I know when it was. I was, it was when I was at Lighteridge, and we were in a, we had barracks there, and there was a lady there, a Vietnamese lady that did the cleaning up and did some laundry or whatnot, or did some housekeeping type work in that area. There were several ladies, in fact, and that's where they were, and we liked them, you know. We'd been nice to them. They couldn't speak English. I couldn't speak Vietnamese. But all the guys, pretty much, and I remember going and feeling good by buying them a carton of Salem cigarettes. They liked our Cools. I can't remember which it was. It was one of the menthol cigarettes. I didn't smoke, so I just remember going and getting them and giving them to them. They liked it. They were thankful, you know, and I just generally found them to be pleasant people, very different than me. But that was the first, but I had other encounters later on down the road.
Now, were they like hooch maids, and they cleaned up the barracks
and shiny
shoes?
Yeah, hooch maids, I guess. They didn't shiny shoes. I heard about that. They didn't shiny any of our shoes. They just kind of came in and cleaned the place up.
Were you given any kind of, I'm sorry, go ahead.
The other, but at the same time, we would go into Da Nang and catch public, or not public, military transportation, like a bus or something. And I remember we would, the kids would come up to us, and this was very early on, and beg for, you know, had their hands out. And a lot of times, we learned later not to give them anything. New guys would, you know, give them some money or maybe or something, whatever. But then, I remember one day, we were boarding the bus, and kids, we said, "Nah, kid, go away, we're getting on the bus." And boy, this kid came up and just took a rock, a very close train, and just hit me in the back of it, and it hurt. I mean, and then he did the same thing to another guy, and the other guy was higher ranking than I was, and we turned around, you know, and the guys on the bus said, it's that one, you know, and they started pointing to a couple of the kids in the group, and boy, this higher ranking guy ran over and grabbed this kid. I mean, just knocked the hell out of him, you know, and it was that type of thing, you know. And then I know one guy got his watch stolen from the guy on the motor scooter that came by real fast and stole it. There was that kind of thing going on. There was an ambivalence. I mean, some of the people we liked, some of the people we didn't like. It was, could tell some of the people liked us there, a lot of people did not like us there. And we were getting an interaction. Again, you know, the guy hits you with a rock in the back, you're getting an opinion formed, you know. But at the same time, the Vietnamese people were very, very oppressed, poor people. It was pathetic, really. You felt sorry for them, you know.
What did you hear about the government
corrupt, totally corrupt. You know, and there was a, later on when I was in a place called Ann Wallace for a couple of days, they, you know, there's a private plane, a little Cessna flying around up there, and this guy would land on the, you know, field, and he'd come out, he was in the mid-40s probably, in Vietnamese, and they said that he, you know, was totally into graft and corruption, and I don't know that he was or not, but I suspect that he probably was, and that was the rumor, and that was what the word was within the military, and, you know, he flew around this Cessna, and he was a rich guy, and he was making all kinds of money off the war, and you know, the war was just chewing up Vietnamese. You know, Americans were dying over there, but the Vietnamese were dying wholesale. I mean, just more than wholesale. I mean, just they were just being chewed up.
Mm-hmm.
So we felt it was corrupt.
Mm-hmm. And were you given any instructions on your interactions with Vietnamese people in terms of restrictions or whatever?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I first got to the White Elephant, we were told, and the guy in charge there, the commander, who happened to be from Texas, I remember from San Antonio, he came in and got in Musgraves. He came in and he said, I'm not making any idle threats. He said, if you get caught over in the Ville, I will, and I forget what the punishment was. It was severe. We were not to go off. And he said, now listen, the reason for this is, and he actually explained the reason, and I was pretty impressed. He said, if they catch you over there, you know, they can torture you and send pictures of you back to your families. They can just do a lot of things that are bad for you, the country, the family, the effort. He said, you just can't go over into the Ville. And he said, and people are doing it. I know they're doing it. And we catch them, they're going to be in very big trouble. And he said, I'm just telling you that. So we were told not to go into the Ville. Now, obviously, with interaction with the people, we were, you know, told not to, you know, give them money if they were begging or not to basically be careful because, you know, they could kill you. I mean, there might be somebody out to assassinate an American. And just kind of keep your distance, basically.
While you were there, did that ever happen, to your knowledge?
No, I'm not aware of it. And we had a guy that was cutting our hair, and somebody said he was for sure a VC, but who knows?
A VC barber.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, it was interesting. He was a draft-age guy. He wasn't in the military.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't want to pursue that. That's what somebody said. You know. We bought those rubber sandals from them that now today, you know, the Teva sandal looks, I remember first time I saw those Teva sandals in a hiking magazine, I went, man, look, and they were made out of, you know, car tires, and then they had rubber straps on top, and those things were fantastic, and we were told, yeah, go ahead and buy those, and you're funding the VC when you do, but everybody did, or I did, and I mean, they were great shoes, and they were just perfect for being over there, but we were told, well, you buy a pair of them, you just bought, you know, bullets for the VC, but I didn't know if that was true or not and didn't really care. You know, they were good shoes, so I bought them from them.
Mm-hmm.
And they had black market stands all over the place. I mean, that was another interesting thing. You could go over to the supply place and not be able to get something, go right out on the street and buy it from the Vietnamese that you needed, you know, a pair of boots or a belt or whatever. And it was open, easy to do. In fact, I did it. I bought some what they called tiger camouflage clothes right there off the street from the guy. It was a kind of a specialized special forces camouflage, you know, uniform.
Mm-hmm.
I bought at black market.
Now, were you supposed to wear a particular uniform when you were on the boat or when you were?
Yeah,
we just
wore army fatigues, green fatigues. But if you wanted to go buy some camouflage stuff and wear it, you could do it, and I did.
Oh, okay. So there was flexibility.
There was some flexibility, but you couldn't wear civilian clothes. Or,
no.
Let's put it this way: in Da Nang, you could not. Now, down south in the south in Saigon, I understand they wore civilian clothes all the time. I did not have any civilian clothes at all. And, you know, and all the dress whites and blues, we just took those and put them away. They told us to put something in there to keep it from mildewing and rotting, but we wore military green T-shirts, green underwear, boots, those jungle boots, which were a good shoe, and then green fatigues. And if you want to go pay some money and get some camouflage tiger stripes, then that was, you know, you could do that if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say you were told not to go in the Ville, you're talking about Da Nang.
That's correct. Da Nang, you know, and they had what, a suburb of Da Nang, or just the, up down the road, you know, there was just villages, and yes, and I did, you know, and that was, and you went in there for prostitution purposes.
Oh.
And that was for girls.
Oh.
Yeah, and so that's the reason you went into the Ville. If you were going to go into the Ville, and I put on, actually found some aftershave, and I put it on. I hadn't used any aftershaves in a long time. The guy came up to me and goes, oh, are you going into the Ville tonight? No, I'm not. And I only went into the Ville one time, and I did it one time just to say I had done it.
Mm-hmm.
But guys were in and out of the Ville all the time. And the word I heard was, you know, you get caught by the shore patrols, and you were telling them, look, they're going to fine me X number of dollars, therefore I'll give you X number of dollars. And why don't we just call this thing even? And the shore patrol was going for that.
Whoa, whoa. Guys would pay their way out of...
Yeah.
Getting caught by shore patrol?
Right. It's petty shore patrol.
Okay.
Does that surprise you? I mean, no, I mean, I'm not saying it was that case every time, but it certainly was going on a lot.
Yeah. Now, what about the Vietnamese police? Were they around?
Yeah, what do they call them, the white mice?
Yeah.
Yeah, the QCs or whatever they were.
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah, they were there, but I didn't deal with them at all. I mean, I just saw them. You know, I could see them, and I knew the uniform when I saw it, but I never had any dealings with them whatsoever.
Were there many fights when sailors go into town?
Fights?
They're in bars and stuff getting drunk.
So. Well, now, if you go into town in Da Nang, you're off limits.
Oh, okay.
So as far as I know, no, there were not any fights or whatever. I never heard of anybody going over there and not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
But, now, if you want to go legitimately have a beer, get drunk at a bar, or listen to some music, you did it on base.
Okay.
And there was no fight that I ever saw. Okay. I'm not saying it didn't happen. Now, there was a lot of stuff that went on in the shadows.
Mm. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not saying somebody didn't jump somebody,
okay,
that type deal, and I'm sure it probably did. I didn't see that much of it, and I didn't see any of that. I didn't really where we worked. Again, we were a little bit of a higher subculture. We all had top secret clearances, and if we got in trouble, we lost them, and that meant we were out on the fleet doing some kind of terrible, you know, job. You could go to riverboats. Riverboats was the worst thing that could happen to you, I suppose. It was always a threat over your head. You didn't get, you know, you didn't keep your act together. You were going to leave this nice air-conditioned 12-hour on, 12-hour off, 7-day-a-week job, and you were going to go out on riverboats. If you think this is bad, you try it out there. Talk to Watson. He's been out there 2 weeks. That's what they do, that kind of stuff. And Watson would confirm, yes, you don't want to go to riverboats, you know, me being Watson, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And because I went there at the very beginning. But and plus, in the meantime, Worrell was killed out there. You know, we knew Worrell. You know, Worrell was a guy I went to school with. So, you know, you had the threat of always losing that top secret clearance. So our group was, by and large, pretty disciplined, managed group.
Okay. Now, did your base get mortared, rocketed, strikes?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, our base, Kenshaw, got hit by rockets, actually. The time I was there, I'd say 3 or 4 times, mortars a few times. It was so big that, you know, your chances of getting hit by one of those things was pretty small. We already, one officer was killed, I think, and it hit his barracks, and somebody else was killed, but it was so far away, you didn't know who it was anyway, so it was pretty small. And hitting Kenshaw, they did it, I guess, for morale purposes. I don't know what their goal was, because we were just a bunch of people working in an office somewhere else, but, it did get rocketed, and, you know, we could see them, you know, we could hear them coming over, and we got underneath our bunks or went in the bunker or whatever. Kenshaw was a real safe place. Which, by the way, I hear is still there. I got on the internet the other day and guessed that he went over there and saw it.
Hmm.
But, Da Nang was safe. Da Nang and the White Elephant were safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could hear about things going off. We heard some machine gun fire with this and that, but it was a safe place.
Mm-hmm. Well, of the radio traffic that you saw, the teletype traffic you saw, you already mentioned the Vietnamization and some of the stuff going on in Laos and Cambodia. Was there anything else that struck you as interesting or odd concerning that traffic that you were privy to?
No, I can't really say. I remember those particularly, and I guess there might have been other stuff, but no, not really. It was just mostly, occasionally we'd get some information about somebody got in trouble. You know, we'd always read that.
Yeah.
Maybe he was some officer. I remember one time we talked about an officer that we read a deal that he was trading currency back and forth and making money doing it, somehow going from piastres to greenbacks. You know, greenbacks over there, which, you know, American money, was very valuable. And, boy, I don't remember. We were supposed to use either the military-type money they gave us. We were not supposed to use greenbacks.
Mm-hmm.
But if you wanted to black market back and forth, I mean, the option was there. If you knew, understood it, and understood arbitrage or however they were doing it, you could do it. And we got messages that people were doing that, and military people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they were getting caught, and we'd read those, that type of deal.
What would happen to those who got caught?
I don't know. You know, they were officers. They probably got kicked out of the military. I don't know what happened to them. You know, I really don't.
And did you get any traffic about My Lai or similar incidents?
You know, My Lai happened in March of 68, and I was in radio school then, and we heard about it. And I can tell you that, sir.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
when we heard about Mylai, I was in, like I say, March of 68, I believe, when that happened, and we didn't, I just heard about it as I would stateside anybody else.
Okay.
When I got to Vietnam, though, I distinctly remember them talking about things have changed now. I mean, we don't go around, you know, just blowing people away. We don't just pull a bunch of people out there, you know, in front of and shoot their father and trying to get information out of them, because Mylai changed all that. Now, we heard that. I don't know if, in fact, that was really what was going on or not. But we heard that after Mylai, you had to be a little bit kinder, gentler. I mean, the tactics had changed. The press had found out there was some stuff going on that, you know, they shouldn't be, and there was, you know, and the military was therefore, you know, calming people down, if you will. And that's kind of what we heard. And I personally never saw any of that.
Okay. What about, while you were there, did you hear about anything that happened in Hue during Tet of 68?
No. That stuff about the Vietnamese coming in and doing in their assassinations and everything was not, I can remember, being heard of at all.
Okay.
I didn't hear about it. And again, I'm a low-ranking guy. They're not necessarily going to fill me in. But no, we didn't hear any about that. It was all, you know, as far as, no, that was news. I think I remember hearing that after I got out of the military, you know, when I was discharged.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time. I kept up with it pretty good. I mean, I followed on the news. I mean, I read the paper, and I was interested in, you know, how this thing was going to play itself out, because I'd been there, and I'd seen it, I had some emotional involvement, and I was wondering that thing was all news. That was news to everybody, I think. That the North Vietnamese actually came in and committed those atrocities during Hue and during Tet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what else did you do? I should ask you first, how long did you work at the White Elephant?
Okay, I worked at the White Elephant. Let's see, I would have gotten there. No, that's in the fall of, I think it's about through November through February 68 and then 69. I was there during the presidential election. I remember being very involved with that, and we would go, and some of us would get together after work and talk about that election coming up, and that was the big deal. And so I left there and went to what they call teletype repair at the Triangle about February, I guess, January, February of 69, which was down the road not across the river. And it was still a big part of the NSA denying communications. And there were two basic places, the Triangle or the White Elephant inside Da Nang. And I went over to the other compound, sort of place. Still stayed in Tinshaw, but worked at the Triangle. And there I worked in teletype repair, which was a pretty good deal. I was lucky to get into that, really.
How long did you do that?
And then I got, I guess, into about a month and a half, and then I went from there down to Sao Win from teletype repair. In fact, I went down to Sao Win as a teletype repair person, only to find out there was no teletypes down there. And I started working radios and doing the crypto work down there, actually.
Now, you mentioned just a moment ago that this was a joint, I guess, military-navy/NSA communications point.
It was all Navy.
All Navy?
Yeah, NSA, Naval Support Activity.
Oh, I apologize.
Yeah, I'm sorry, too. I'm sorry.
That's what you meant.
NSA was Naval Support Activity, and it was all the Navy. And,
okay.
NSA Da Nang was where the Navy was in Da Nang. We had NSA detachments, or NSA Da Nang detachment, Sao Win, Qua Viet, Dong Ha, Chu Lai, on and on. But
okay.
The main one was the hub, was NSA Da Nang.
Different NSA.
Yeah.
But were there any civilians that worked in that area?
Yes,
with
there
you?
Were. There were some highly trained, and I understand, highly paid and well-paid civilians that came in occasionally and did some high-end technical work on the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And that was throughout. That was in Vietnam. Plus, that in when I was down in Beeville, Texas, the same thing. They had civilians that occasionally came in and worked on the equipment. And I heard those guys made good money, especially over Vietnam.
And how about civilians working in other capacities that were a little bit less obvious or more obscure?
Well, now, I saw a lot of reporters,
but
they weren't actually working with the Navy.
Okay.
And I saw a lot of reporters from various parts of the world. I mean, I talked to guys, I had British accents or Australian accents and, that type thing. But I didn't really work with them. I just saw them occasionally here and there. They'd ask me, a lot of times they come over to military personnel and say, do you know where such and such is, or do you know how this or that, or whatever. That was the other civilians I saw, really. I saw a lot of, that were non-Vietnamese civilians.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's see here. Well, was there anything else that you wanted to talk about with regard to your time at the White Elephant?
No. It was very mundane work. It was not a good experience. I mean, I can't remember coming away with it with any kind of anything I'm proud to say that happened there.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a paper shuffling mill. It was. There was a lot of agitation between. I felt like, and I know there was. It wasn't any question about it, between officers and the enlisted.
Mm, okay.
And we felt the officers. Of course, they had a good deal, but they were what we call pricks. They were there just every now and then just to make themselves feel good by making us feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was there, one guy just flat left. He just didn't show up for work for like 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm.
Just decided he wasn't going to. And he didn't really run away. He just kind of went out and hung out by the pool there. Had a big pool there that was built above ground. And you had another guy that came in one day and says, I want to go out into the field. I want to see the most. He got some gifts from Pittsburgh. He came in, he said, I want to go out into the field. I want to go out and see with Marines. I want to be on helicopters. I want the most dangerous duty I can get in Vietnam. He went to the officers and told them this.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, you're crazy. Go back to your job. And people were showing signs of stress. I mean, bottom line is the people were just, it was stressful.
Mm-hmm.
That many hours, that long period of time, that nothing to do off duty, and it was just stressful place.
So he wasn't sent out?
No, he was not sent out. Now, here, they were threatening you all the time with the riverboats and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
And this guy came in and says, flat out, I want to go. Send me. Quit talking about it. Let's do it. They didn't do it. Well, they may not have had a slot for him. First of all, they weren't going to send him out to the field with the Marines.
Uh-huh.
You know, they might send him over there to the riverboats like he wanted him, but they may not have had a slot right then or whatever. Or they might have just realized he was under stress,
Yeah.
But,
Well, do you think he was sincere in his offer?
Yeah, I do. I knew Peter Zegel was a really good guy. He was one of the buddies of mine, and he was German. His father fought for the Germans in World War II, and he was a super guy. I really liked him, and I think he was sincere as he could be. He just had enough of this place, Mm-hmm. Send me someplace else.
No, well, besides the conflict between the officers and the enlisted men, what was the atmosphere like at the White Elephant?
It was just it just was an unpleasant place. I mean, it just, you just went in and did your job,
mm-hmm.
conversed a little bit with a few people, but, a mail call was an uplift, and some people would get packages with candy and whatnot, and that was nice, but I can't really say there was anything going on there that was anything but just a grind, just a day in and day out grind. It was interesting. Here I go as a low-ranking guy, deal like this was beyond me, but this one guy comes over to me and says, Watson, there's a grunt here to see you. And I went up to the front, and there was a buddy I went to high school with here in Vietnam. He was a Marine. And they said, well, here, go on outside and talk to him. I was surprised they even let me do that, and I did. But and that was a sign of compassion on their part, which I didn't think they had any, but in that case, I guess there was a little compassion here. They're going to let Watson talk to a buddy of his.
Mm-hmm.
But no, there wasn't much there at the White Elephant. I was on the internet, and somebody sent me some pictures. Said, "Here's some pictures of the White Elephant from the river." And I was looking at it. This was about 3 or 4 months ago, and I thought, "Is that the White Elephant?" It just didn't look like at all what I remembered. You know?
Mm.
It had a lot of radio antennas off the top of it. I remember that.
Mm-hmm. And how far could you receive communications from? How far?
On radio, we could go, 100 miles or a couple hundred miles. But teletypes are pretty much how we were getting all our stuff. And a lot of the voice communications was to the other detachments. And, they were 100, 150 miles away, maybe. And a lot of the communication was to the USS Repose, which is a hospital ship right across the river from us.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of communication on voice with that. But I'm going to say 100, 150 miles would be the furthest on the radio. And I could be wrong about that. I think that's right, because when I was down south, we talked to them, and I think that's how far we were then. We were talking to NSA Da Nang there in the White Elephant,
mm-hmm.
and I think we're about 150 miles away.
And what about the teletype? What was the range for that typically?
Well, I guess those, I don't know, but I think they were like around the world somehow. I mean, we were getting messages in from all over the world. We were going on what they call Zulu time, which is mm-hmm. Greenwich means time, and we got messages all the time from all over the world. Mm-hmm. But we get a message from a ship that was on the other side of the planet. Now, I don't know how it got there, and I don't really know how it was relayed. They probably explained it to me one time. I don't remember, but we teletypes were everywhere. You know, there was no distance factor. And, you know, occasionally, if an emergency arose, you know, you get a teletype in from the United States where some guy's parents dying or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So you would get those types of notifications?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm curious about your attitude or the overall attitude of the personnel at the White Elephant. Was it different from the Riverboat? You mentioned previously that it wasn't very friendly. You were treated like the stereotypical Vietnam slang, FNG. Was it different at the White Elephant at all?
Well, there was more FNGs at the White Elephant.
Okay.
So us FNGs could get together, you know, and form our own little, you know, social group. And whereas on the Riverboat, I was my own by myself. And so, everybody was an FNG no matter where you went. When I went down to South Wind, I was again an FNG, even though I'd been in country that time by 6 or 7 or 8 months. You know, 7 months, I guess. But I was still an FNG because I was new to those guys. But I had some skills at that point, some radio skills and whatnot. So it didn't last very long. I mean, I wasn't FNG very long. But once you worked there a while, and, you know, you made rank. I mean, pretty soon a guy may go from E3 to E4. You know, and you just naturally worked yourself into the organization that way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in the beginning you were kind of ostracized, but
yeah.
You know, and I think that's natural in all of the elements, all of the groups, the military, whatever.
Mm-hmm. And what about race relations?
Now, you know, in the White Elephant, we didn't have any. There were nobody. That was a white elephant, I guess. It was a white people. I don't remember any blacks being there at all. I don't remember any Hispanics. I don't remember any Native Americans. I don't remember any Asians that were American, that were military. All I remember was white guys. All I ever remember seeing, I don't think there was one. Now, I take that back. You know, I said, okay, now when I got to the Triangle in Teletower Repair, there was a guy from Detroit there, and there was another guy, there were two black guys, one of them was from Detroit and one was someplace else. And the Detroit black guy was a radical. I mean, he was an E5, and he hated white people. He was pretty much, that was his opinion. And he tolerated, and he didn't get along well. And he would go up to us low-ranking guys. I saw him do this to other people. He didn't do it to me. And say, hey, man, can I have a drink out of your Coke? And, or your soda or whatever. And, you know, they would kind of like this guy outranked him. He could pull some stuff later, you know. They'd usually give it to him and then not take it back was what the way they'd worked that deal. But I remember distinctly, the guy's name was Ward, and he was a very clean guy. He spit-shined his boots, and he brushed his teeth all the time. He was a clean, squared-away, uniform was always in good shape. And so one day he was drinking a Coke, and I went over to him. I said, hey, Ward, how about a drink of your Coke? and he looked at me like, you know, kind of weird. And I said, well, hey, you're doing it to everybody else. So what about when it happens to you? And so he gave me a sip of it. I took a big, long gulp out of it and gave it back to him. About halfway irritated him, I think.
Okay. Now,
go ahead.
I'm curious. What, was there something else you're going to add?
No, I mean, Ward later, mm-hmm. and I really got sideways. And we, later, I mean, he and I just hated each other's guts. But
okay.
I found out later he was supposedly one of the biggest drug dealers there on the base. I don't know that for a fact. I heard it later, though.
Well, was there a prevalence of drugs there that you witnessed?
Yeah, it was if you wanted drugs and you wanted to hang in that area, it was always there. And I did not particularly want to do that. I mean, I was a guy who went across the road and drank beer at the club, and that's what I hung around. That's the kind of guys I hung around with. If you wanted to hang around people that did drugs, they were there. You could get in with that group if you wanted to. Personally, I didn't like that group. I thought they were seedy. I thought they were underachievers. They didn't look like to me they were going in the direction I wanted to go. But I did a couple of times go over and say, okay, now what's this marijuana thing? Because I'd heard about it. I'd never experienced it in the United States. Here it was in Vietnam, so let's go over here and try it out. So one night we went over and smoked some pot, and I never did find anything about it. I found, you know, enjoyable one way or the other. But I could say at that point, you know, I'd smoke pot in Vietnam. So
okay.
Just like I went over to the Ville. I went over and did it one time to say that I had been to the Ville. Yes, I had been to the Ville. I wasn't going to be, you know, mm-hmm. say sitting around a bunch of guys that I had never been to the Ville, and they were going a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But
So I just did it one time. I tried it one time. That was it. Okay. But yeah, the drugs are there if you wanted them.
Okay.
And a lot of guys got into them. A lot of guys, I think, got themselves screwed up with them.
Hmm. Now, did you ever hear of anybody getting in trouble for using drugs?
No, I actually in Vietnam never did. Now, in stateside, when we got back, yes, I heard about guys getting in trouble. And they got caught doing drugs at B-ville. Had a gun, got radio man that got caught, and he was kicked out and put out of the radio shack where the clearance was and put over into the, I think, working on cars or doing the motor pool servicing or whatever. He got kicked, he got his secret clearance sure enough taken away, and I don't know whatever happened to him. And then, mm-hmm. But it didn't seem like it was too terribly bad. I mean, they mm-hmm. just took him, put him in another area.
Okay. And let's see. Did you ever receive any of the briefings about drugs while you were at the White House?
Yeah, I think occasionally there would be a meeting, you know, and they would talk about drugs and you know, you need to stay away from them. And I know one time we had a meeting, and this was not in Vietnam. This was later. They talked about how, well, they said, okay, they say marijuana is not physically addicting, but you can get psychologically addicted to it, and just like you can get psychologically addicted to beer. They were getting more tamer, I guess you could say is the word, that to their, how they were going to philosophize about it. Okay, now look, you know, when the word's coming out, it's not really a heroin, but marijuana. But they were trying to say, look, it's just bad, just be careful. It's just like bad, you know, too much debt, too much whatever, just over excess. And it is illegal, by the way, and if you get caught doing it, you're going to lose your clearance. And here's an example of some guy that did. And that sort of thing. It was becoming less of a threat and more of a, less of a iron-fisted threat and more of a rational type approach.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, let's see. So when
I'm sorry. There was another time they talked about LSD, and they talked about how, you know, you might go out and smoke some pot, and it might not be such a bad deal, and you might go out and drink beer and have a bad hangover, but if you've got LSD, they were talking about how you could have a recurring flashback. And it wouldn't just be a Saturday night deal. You could have that flashback while you were on watch. Now, this was very serious. Of course, who in the hell's doing LSD? I don't know. But they were telling us that LSD had the potential for a flashback later. You know, it could stay in your system. And then while you're on watch in a very critical time, you know, doing your job, you could, this thing could come back. Whereas marijuana, they told you flat out that was not going to happen. And booze, obviously, that was not going to happen. But I remember them stressing the fact that doing LSD could really carry over into your duties. And which made sense. If that's true, you could get a flashback. And, you know, you certainly wouldn't want to do LSD.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember them talking about that. And I remember, you know, listening to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And but nobody you knew was actually using acid or.
No, LSD. I can't say that. Okay. Now, when I went to boot camp and when I went to radio school and when I went to Vietnam, there was a guy named, I don't guess I ought to say his name, but he was in Detroit. He and I were good buddies, and he was one of the guys that volunteered for Vietnam. And I went over to him and said, "You crazy? You volunteered for Vietnam?" And I ended up going too. But we got over there, and we met up with another guy from Los Angeles, and us three were kind of running buddies, and we all were just, you know, beer drinkers, philosophers type deal. I didn't like the war, didn't like, you know, this sort of thing. We just got together and talked, but those two guys went off and really started doing a lot of drugs, and the other guy from L.A. was getting it in, supposedly. I was hearing this from a guy, from my buddy from Detroit. They were getting it in from, you know, the States, and they were getting a shipment in, this and that, and I just broke it off, and I stayed in touch with the guy from Detroit, and I said, "How's it going?" And, well, it turns out the guy from L.A. just really got himself physically in bad shape. It's my understanding he did not finish out his tour in Vietnam due to drugs, and he was a very capable, intelligent person, and the guy from Detroit told me that, you know, that later he, was having a problem with drugs, and when I got stateside, he called me up one day, mm-hmm. and he came over to my house in Dallas, Texas, and said, "I need to get some, you know, drugs. Do you know where I can go?" I said, "Well, it's Mexico, 300 miles," and literally, he hitchhiked to Mexico from my house and said he went down there and got a bunch of amphetamines and drugs, and the guy had never been to Texas before in his life.
Wow.
Yeah, and then he called me from down there and said, "I'm on my way back. I'm on a bus, and I've been busted." And this is the guy I've been to Vietnam with, you know, and he came back and, you know, he was in bad shape. And they said that the Border Patrol found him down there, found out he was a Vietnam veteran, took all the money out of his pockets, bought him a bus ticket, and gave him the rest of the money back and shipped him back to my house, literally,
mm-hmm.
and which I then took him out to Love Field and put him on an airplane. I haven't seen or heard from him since.
Wow.
I mean, the guy got messed up on drugs, and he was a buddy of mine.
Mm-hmm.
I literally saw him at my own hometown.
My goodness.
Yeah, really weird.
Well, so when you left the White Elephant, went to Teletype Repair, was there anything else in particular that occurred there at the Triangle?
No, not really.
You were only there for about a month and a half?
Yeah, about a month and a half. There was, again, more agitation. There was, again, there was some racial, starting to get some racial tensions there, starting to get a little of that there. There was, no, I was becoming one of the group there. I was starting to get some skills. I was starting to debate, if you will, with the career people about the pros and cons of the war, pros and cons of the military, and I was being accepted by some of them and not accepted by others. No, I can't really say it was anything in particular. I remember trying to think. I probably think of some after Gulf Foam, but nothing, it was, of real relevance.
Mm-hmm.
The work was somewhat interesting. Uh-huh. I found out when I take a telepipe repair and how to put it back together, I had to admit I enjoyed the work somewhat, and getting it to work correctly was kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you left in about April of 69 and went to Saw when?
Yeah, that must have been March. I guess mid-March of 69.
Oh, March?
I'm guessing. Okay. I sent all these letters back home, and I don't know whatever happened to them. Mom apparently didn't hang on to them. But I must say it was March of 69.
Yeah. Did you receive many?
Oh, yeah.
Your family?
Oh, yeah, from girlfriends and family. Sure did.
Okay. Would they talk about what was happening at home?
My mother made the comment that she saw on TV the rocket attack that I just mentioned a minute ago about we got a guy, an officer killed mm-hmm. or something. She said they saw that on TV.
Hmm.
She said, we saw y'all getting attacked on, TV.
My goodness.
So I guess they got the footage. I'm sure it wasn't live.
Right.
But the footage came in on Walter Cronkite. They're headed on CBS,
mm-hmm.
I guess. I really didn't. There was a lot going on about Vietnam. I found that out. When I got back, everybody's attitude was different than when I left. My friends, everything. I mean, it was like, wow, man, And they knew stuff that I was like, yeah, that's right, that did happen. And there was a lot, from between the time I went there from September of 68 till I got back in May of 69, a huge amount of Vietnam
mm-hmm.
had happened, they'd write letters and say, we read about that in the paper, we heard about this, saw it on the news.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're old enough to remember that, but, they had a body count every night.
Mm-hmm.
Walter Cronkite would have little pictures of not pictures, but little stick men there up there. It said, this many Vietnamese got killed and this many Americans got killed. One of them was red, one of them was in blue, and our numbers were always much less than their numbers. It was
mm-hmm.
a disgusting thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here was a body count every night on TV, a report, if you will, how many soldiers were killed on each side.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going on every night, every weeknight of the world.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever talk to your, while we're on the subject, did you ever talk to your folks about that?
About what?
Or did, the fact that every night they'd watch TV and there'd be footage, combat footage of what was happening, and sometimes it would be very close to where you were, and every night they emphasized, this is how many Americans were killed, this is how many Vietnamese were killed.
I can't say that I talked about that particular
mm-hmm.
thing. Now, when I got back from Vietnam, I talked about it quite a bit, and we had differences of opinion. And my father, and I was going to go do some protests, and I joined the VVAW, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and I was going to go to Houston to do a big protest march. And he said, flat out, you're not going and live in this house or to be in this house or whatever. And I said, well, wait a minute. I've been over there. And we got in this big fight. And then in the election of 72 was, again, McGovern versus Nixon. And this was when we had the opportunity at the ballot box to end the Vietnam War. And I was very much for ending the Vietnam War. I thought it was wrong. And what I'd seen over there just galvanized that feeling. And so here we had McGovern. It said flat out on Inauguration Day, I'm going to end the war. Well, I mean, Nixon had drug it up for 4 years. I saw it as a purest form of good versus evil that I'd ever seen in my life. And my parents were for Nixon, as were everybody else, because, McGovern didn't even win his home state. It was a complete landslide. But I didn't care what McGovern's domestic economic opinions were, which were crazy as I look back on it, but he was going to end that war. And my family and us, and me, my brother, my sister, and my mother were against me politically. And I was going, you guys haven't been there. I have. You know, and I've seen these body counts that they're showing you on TV to some degree. And they were just like, hey, you know, we're not going to just up and pull out of that thing. Nixon's got a plan. We're going to get us out of here. And there was a lot of rancor between my family, me and my family, you know, unfortunately.
Now, at that point, had it become public knowledge that the war had expanded into Laos and Cambodia?
72. No. Yes, absolutely. I mean, we went into Cambodia in, what, May of 70, and that was when Kent State and all that shooting went on.
Right.
And then the election from between McGovern and Nixon was 72. Mm-hmm. I was in college, actually, when and out of the military when the election between McGovern and Nixon came out. And then, of course, I was still in the military when the Cambodian and Laos or Cambodian deal was going on in Kent State, and that was in May of 70. So, yeah, I mean, we knew we'd expanded it, and Nixon had expanded it going into the election of 72. I guess that's, come to think of it, I guess that's one of the more reasons I was so, you know, had so much passion and fervor about it at that point, because, I mean, I felt like Nixon was absolutely the worst case scenario as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and here McGovern was going to, but people trusted the government still. I mean, I guess they should have. I don't know. I know that there was a lot of animosity within my family itself about that election of 72.
Now, I'm glad you brought up the election because, of course, you had also mentioned the election of 68.
Yeah.
and I was wondering what impact, because this happened before you left for Vietnam.
What's that?
What impact did Johnson's decision not to seek re-election have on you and your, you know, the people you were serving with, but also maybe even your parents' perspective?
Yeah, now, wait a minute. Now, did Johnson, I thought Johnson did that when I was in Vietnam.
No, that would have been early in 68, just after Tet Offensive.
Okay, well, it was close to when I got to Vietnam, because I can tell you this.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Vietnam, you know, Humphrey was going to, the VP for Johnson, was going to run for Prez, which he did, against Nixon. So it was a Humphrey, somebody ticket against Nixon and, wow, it was Nixon's VP, anyway. Isn't that right? Okay, Humphrey was running in 68 against
mm-hmm.
Nixon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I believe so.
Humphrey was the vice president under Johnson. Now, Johnson declined to run, but Humphrey now was going to run, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm just trying to get...
I believe you're right.
I'm pretty sure I'm right about that. Okay, now, this is going on while I'm in Vietnam. Now, there was a thing going on called the bombing of the DMZ, which IB-52s were doing around the clock, okay? The Da Nang is very close to the DMZ, or pretty close. And some of our detachments, like Qua Viet, are right on it. Now, we were told, now, Johnson goes in and says, in order to help Humphrey in that presidential campaign of 68, to help him get votes, stops the bombing of the DMZ. Now, what is that going to do? We were told that if that bombing stopped, we could be overrun. Now, North Vietnamese Army was the fourth largest army in the world. We could have been literally overwhelmed by hordes of North Vietnamese if that bombing stopped. And we were told we could be wiped out within 24 hours. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but it sure as heck happened in 73, just about. North Vietnamese just crushed the South Vietnamese all the way down to Saigon, where we saw the tank coming into the U.S. Embassy. Now, we didn't know what was going to happen, but we were told that without that bombing at the DMZ, could be killed within 24 hours. Okay, Johnson stops that bombing at the DMZ in order to help Humphrey get elected. Now, there was a political cartoon, I'll never forget it, whereas there's a stove and there's pots on the stove, and the chef is, or the guy stirring the pots is Johnson, and right behind Johnson is Humphrey. And one of the pots he's stirring says, stop the bombing of the DMZ, and Humphrey is behind Johnson saying, I knew you'd cook something up for me. Now, here we were being put at the interpretation, and I think it's a fair interpretation, we were being put at risk,
mm-hmm.
our lives, in order for Johnson to get Humphrey elected. Now, to me, where's the outrage?
Yeah.
And to this day, you know, I see those people as war criminals. I just cannot imagine. Now, maybe that wasn't true. But that's what we were told.
Right.
Now, maybe that wasn't really the case, and in fact, it did not happen.
Mm.
The bombing stopped, and we did not get overrun.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we were told, and that's what we... bottom line is, there was a lot of emotion attached to stopping the bombing, even though I was against the war. I sure wasn't against them doing it that way and putting us at risk in order to get Humphrey elected.
Yes.
Now, in 68, at the Democratic Convention in mm-hmm. Chicago, I mean, that was I don't think this country's ever seen anything like that since then, and I hope they never do again. But there was a lot of people and doing a lot of bad things in the street,
mm-hmm.
at least, both on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Can I ask how you are?
Beg your pardon?
May I ask how old you are?
How old I am? Sure, I'm 35.
Okay. Well, okay. But, that was, it was some bad times. I mean, if
sure.
Johnson was going to stop the bombing of the DMZ in order to get Humphrey elected,
mm-hmm.
you know, I got to tell you, too, I'm from Texas. I don't know where you're from, but, you know, when I got into the military, there was a anti-Texas attitude amongst the people that were against the war, and there was a lot of us, because Johnson was considered to be the orchestrator of this war to a large degree.
Mm-hmm.
And if you saw on the campuses throughout the United States, you know, at Berkeley and out on the East Coast, all the campuses, all the Ivy League schools, and on the East and West Coast were doing these violent protests. There was a lot of that, but there was none of that at the University of Texas, okay? And so I'm riding home, I'm going, hey, you guys, how come there's no protesting down at UT? I mean, you guys won the 69 football, you know, conference, number one or whatever. You guys down there, and I was being told this by the people I'm with, they're watching, you know, you guys in Texas, you're down there playing football, and you've got the guy that started this whole campaign, this war. I mean, what is it with you people down there? And I'm thinking, yeah, what is the problem? How come the University of Texas doesn't have these protests? How come they're just going to football games? I mean, Johnson is from there. And I was asking the same questions, and these people were pretty disillusioned with the state of Texas. People from the state of Texas do not realize that to this day. And being from Texas was really another ostracization factor, you know, if you were amongst the people that were against the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of ashamed of my own home state. I mean, I was going, yeah, I mean, we've sent this president down there, and then here there's nobody protesting. You never heard about any students, and I'm not so sure that's what they should have done, but at the time there needed to be some something spoken about their anti, you know, war, because it was going on in all the other schools. Why wasn't it going on down in Texas?
Hmm. And this was a subject that was brought up while you were in Vietnam.
Sure, yeah. We sat around, you know, and talked about it.
Hmm.
And a lot of guys were telling me, saying, you know, Watson, you guys are Neanderthals down there, and here's why, and what can I do to dispute it? And, you know, here I was being slandered literally because I was from Texas. And I didn't get to, I still held my own. I mean, but still, that was something I had to work against. And I can remember reading a book called The Strawberry Connection, which is I read that in Vietnam, which is about, it was an anti, you know, Vietnam movement, the hippie movement, the culture, the whole bit. And the guy made the comments, just three things he didn't like. And I forget what one of them was, but one of them was Texas. You know, that Texas was not a pleasant place philosophically or environmentally or anything else. It was considered to be the problem. Texas was a big part of the Vietnam War. Texas was a huge part of the Vietnam War. Texas was benefiting from it, and the people down there didn't seem to have a problem with that at all. And they seemed to be focused on football and not getting that war stopped. And what could you say? The facts held that out. I came home, and I said, hey, where were you guys? Oh, yeah, we were protesting. I said, I didn't know you weren't because it wasn't in the media. I said, oh, yeah, it was a powder keg down here. I said, well, I don't think so because it never got out. But, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, bottom line is there should have been more coming from Texas, I felt like, from the standpoint of, but, you know, you had a lot of right concern. I'm that way today. I've never voted Democrat except one time in my life, and that was in 72. I voted Republican every time since. But there should have been, in my opinion, the editorialists and the newspapers and whatnot, Dallas Morning News, could have been more pro-Vietnam. And they were just totally conservative, yes, we're doing the right thing, you know, all the way.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I'm sorry, Steve.
No, that was good. I'm curious. You mentioned something very interesting. In what ways did you think Texas was benefiting from the war?
Well, hey,
I mean, again,
now,
this is back in 68 and 69 when you're there.
Let me just tell you, you know, I used to work on those ships, right, those riverboats.
Mm-hmm.
When we were unloading it, things that Texas Instruments, Collins Radio, which is right up here on Central Expressway in 635. I can throw a rock and hit it. It's not there anymore now, but that's when it was then.
Uh-huh.
Collins Radio, Texas Instruments, Bell Helicopter, mm-hmm. Ling Timco Vault. What's the other ones? Hey, come on, there's a bunch of them in this area. My cousins were working, making aircraft parts, I mean, fighter airplane parts of the LTUV.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this economy here was booming because of Vietnam. And those were no question about it, jobs here. It was doing great because of Vietnam. Look at all these corporations that were, there's more than that. I mean, come on, there was Chance Vault. There was another one. Who all those big corporations were here making big bucks off the Vietnam War?
Texas wasn't the only state, by the
way. No, sir, it wasn't, but it was, I wouldn't guarantee the lion's share.
Hmm. Okay. And that was discussed and talked about while you were over there.
Yes, sir.
The fact that Texas had so much industry that was benefiting.
That's right.
Interesting.
It's hard to ignore mm-hmm. the names on the crates.
Right.
Because I had my skateboard in 1965 and 66 skating down through the Collins Radio parking lot late at night on Saturday night, and here a year and a half later I'm unloading their boxes off the, you know, those YFUs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew where this stuff was coming from. There was no doubt in my mind. I'd already skidded my knees in that parking lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, you know, Bell Helicopter, like I say, Bell Helicopter, I mean, it's just a lot of industry in this area that benefited tremendously from that.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention the naval bases, the military bases. I mean, Dallas, look at all the, they had Clean, that was just supplying all that tank warfare. And of course, we didn't have a lot of tanks in Vietnam, but then there was the helicopter training in Mineral Wells,
mm-hmm.
Huge base.
Right.
Sir?
Fort Walters.
Okay, is that it? Yeah. Okay, so all those places were booming, and those economies were doing great because of the Vietnam War.
Reese Air Force Base.
Yeah, where was that one?
Here, in Lubbock.
Oh, in Lubbock? Okay, there you go.
Yeah,
so I mean, Texas was doing great because of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and the people were focusing on.
Hello.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Sure can.
I'm on a radio phone. I'm probably losing my battery. I'm gonna go here and pick up on this hard line.
Okay.
But.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. So, anyway, that was my take on it. I felt like Texas wasn't upholding their responsibilities for getting this thing stopped.
Yes, sir. Okay. All right, so this will end the first CD of the interview with Philip Watson. This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Philip Watson on the 24th of April, 2001. This is CD number 2. All right, why don't we go ahead and discuss your time at Sa Win and the transition from being a IntelliType repair to... Now, exactly, you know, describe what you did there.
Okay, I was at Teletile Repair in the Triangle, and there was about 8 guys there that worked in that department next to a big, huge department of people, guys working on teletypes and whatnot. Now, basically, I got sideways with the chief there, and the chief, I'm sure, in fact, one guy, the chief there was an evil person, I thought, and he had already sent one guy on riverboats and had lamented, you know, in front of everybody that one of the riverboats that blew up the other day didn't have the guy on it that he'd sent over there. Okay, so if you got sideways with the higher ups, you could get yourself killed in the politics, and that's always been through the case of the military, is my understanding, because you know they can just, that a guy didn't like you and he's higher ranking, he can send you out into harm's way. I was therefore sent out in harm's way. I'm pretty sure because this chief did not like me, so I was sent down. Even though I'm teletype repair, there's no teletypes in Southwind, but. It was very small. Boy, on the internet, you can find almost nobody that, you can find occasionally somebody that was there, but never heard about it. I actually ran across one guy that's been there. And it was a small place. It was, very hot at the time. When I say hot, I mean it was being attacked. It was, getting mortared. It was, dangerous place. And down there, it was just Sa Win was a Vietnamese village, and next to it was a very nice natural port, and that's no coincidence as to why the Navy had a stopping off place there. And the river boats would come down the shoreline, not a river, but down the shoreline, and then would pull in, and we would unload. And there were 80 guys on there, and there were 4 radiomen, and we would send the material out into the field for the Army. And it was a when
I got down there, it was very different than what I'd been so far. I mean, I had 7 months of Vietnam at Da Nang. This was very different. We, you know, we carried a rifle at all times with us, or a 45. We had, you could hear sounds of, you know, shooting at night a lot. You know, bombs going on, bombs, mortars going off, artillery rounds. The Army was getting it on quite often with over next to us. They had a base right next on the hill above us. In fact, we interacted with the Army quite a bit, and I made friends with some of those guys. I was much more involved in the war at this point. I wasn't in Vietnam. I wasn't on Tin Shaw. You know, this was getting close to it. So, and I got there because I think the chief didn't like me.
Did you yourself get fired at quite a bit at that base, or?
We took mortar rounds.
Okay.
And the 2 months that I was there, I mean, this doesn't sound like a lot, but you know, believe me, we got hit, you know, once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I mean, maybe we'd go 2 weeks without getting, and then all of a sudden we'd get an attack. Now, the commanding officer would pull us all out and say, okay, now look, here's what intelligence tells us. We're ripe to get hit, he says. We understand there is an offensive building up, which there was. And we expect to take a big brunt of that because they don't, you know, this area was where a lot of materials were coming in. They could knock us out. They could, you know, cut the supply of materials. And therefore, that we were strategically something that the military and the enemy would like to take out of action.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's see. When you say you were mortared, how accurate typically was that fire?
Very well. Now we didn't get rocketed, so rockets weren't that accurate, but they were more powerful. But the mortars were feared more, even though they were less powerful. They were, you could walk them in. Now, they were considered to be a problem. Now, once we got inside a bunker, we had sandbag bunkers and whatnot. Yeah, we weren't worried too much. They could hit a bunker and probably, unless they hit a real solid direct hit, probably nobody inside would get killed because we were pretty protected. Now, but we had to go out into the, you know, to the trenches around there and fire back and whatnot. And, you know, the whole time I was there, I never had a guy killed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we'd had guys killed prior.
Mm-hmm.
I guess probably I was one of the closer ones to getting killed, but their stuff was coming in. It was raining in. I mean, you know, if it hit one of those floating fuel barges, we could have died of some kind of gas, you know, because of the fuel smoke or whatnot, or it would let out. In fact, we had gas masks for that reason. It wasn't. What was your question?
No, I was just curious the accuracy when they would fire mortars into your compound.
Well,
you know, had they obviously, you know, staked out or
they weren't very accurate, actually, I guess, because they never did while I was there hit anything of any strategic consequence.
Okay.
They hit right in the front door of our hooge, which, you know, but that's not the place I'm sure they were aiming, and you know, they went off in various places, but they never did hit the floating fuel barges. They never did hit the CO's headquarters. They never did. Bottom line is they would hit and run. They would send some mortars in, and by that time, you know, we'd have a helicopter come in or we'd shoot back or whatever, and they'd be scurried away.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever probed by sappers or anything like that?
They said on Christmas Day that they were, mm-hmm. and I wasn't there, but they said that happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some sappers came in on low tide or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And what about the composition of the enemy in that area? Who was firing the mortars at you?
We were told it was the NVA, and I'm sure that's true. I never saw one. I never saw an NVA guy, but the Army. And then again, I was communicating with the communication guys at the Army, who knew more than we did, really. And I'd go over and talk to those guys, even when I was off duty and whatnot. And
mm-hmm.
They said it's NVA. I mean, their NVA is very strong in this area, and the NVA was considered to be a really good trained force of people, you know, good uniforms and everything.
Right. Now, where in relation to Da Nang was Sao Win?
I think it was right. Well, Sao Win is right on the line between 2 Corps and I Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And I have looked this up before, and I don't remember the number. I'm guessing 150 miles south of Da Nang on the coastline. And again, wherever 2 Corps, I Corps, and that could be researched real fast, and
mm-hmm.
I can get you that answer. I just off the top of my head.
Oh, I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, that's where it is, and it's the Ashaw Valley, where Hamburger Hill and a lot of stuff went on, is right where it's at as well.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, the movie Hamburger Hill took place exactly the same time that I got wounded. In fact, I was watching that movie one time, and as they were doing it, they would put up a date, and they would go May 10th, 1969, you know. I was hit on May 12th, 1969, and they would go to May 11th, 1969. I said, oh, yeah, they're going to show my date next. They skipped over it and went to May 13th. But there was a lot going on right then. That was that Ho Chi Minh birthday offensive, which was considered to be, I think, the second Tet. And it started that night of May 12th, as I understand it. Well, that's when we started getting hit. I know that. Mm-hmm. It was ongoing there for quite a while.
Okay.
If you look at the date, Texas has a, down at Fair Park, has a Vietnam Veterans Wall, like not unlike the one at in Washington, D.C., and they have dates on the one at the Texas Wall.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look, there is a huge number of May 12th, 1969 people that got killed that day.
Now, prior to that engagement where you were injured, though, in terms of the overall scheme of things, you were providing support to the Army units, and they were doing patrolling in that area?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, they were. I mean, we were listening to them on the radios. Their patrols would go out at night and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Did they make a lot of heavy contact?
I don't know about a lot. They made contact. It was a bridge, and for some reason, it wasn't a very big bridge. It was almost nothing. It was like just a few boards over a low area, but boy, for some reason, the Vietnamese really wanted that, and the Army would send patrols out, and that's where a lot of fighting took place, over that so-called bridge, and, mm-hmm. you know, we would hear them in firefights, and it would just sound like rain. I mean, it would hear rain, it'd be kind of light rain, you'd hear heavy rain. Well, that's just how the firing would be. I mean, then we'd hear them on the radio. Again, I'm listening on the radio. That's one thing about being a radio, and you get to hear it. I mean, I'd be listening to those guys talk to each other, and I remember hearing all the firing stopped one night, and we could hear no shooting. And I heard a guy on the radio go, it was an Army guy, go, they're throwing rocks at us. And he said, are you serious? And he said, yeah, those guys are throwing rocks at us. And we could hear this kind of thing. We'd also hear the helicopters talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one helicopter guy, they were working in tandem, and they would come in, they would be called in, and of course those rockets off those pods were loud, and they were shooting down this one rocket, this one commanding guy on the helicopter was saying, you know, I'm afraid to go into that spot you just, you know, shot into. I saw some fire come out of there, and blah, blah, this, and so.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of action, I don't know, quite a bit. You know, I remember hearing about it, I mean, seeing it from a distance at night, and then hearing them talk on the radios, both on the ground and in the air.
Mm-hmm. Now, that incident where they were throwing rocks, did they, was this at night?
Yes.
Did anybody put the possibility that they were apes? Because I understand that apes used to do that a lot.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that too. I've heard that, the rock apes.
Mm-hmm.
And those were up on Monkey Mountain. But I don't think that was the case this particular night.
Okay.
And I don't know that to be the case. I remember this. I remember what the guys on the ground said, they're throwing rocks at us.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember the lieutenant or whoever was back at headquarters commenting, well, boy, they must be hurting, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, meaning, obviously, that was a pretty good comeback, I thought. And the guy says, yeah, but then they went back to shooting. But there was a little bit of that interplay between, you know, ground troops. I mean, they might get into it, you know, stop fighting for a while and
mm-hmm.
play around with each other a little bit. I don't think that was rock apes that night.
Okay.
But you know, I have heard that too, and I'd forgotten all about that. But I never saw that myself, and I just heard that from other people.
Yeah. And while we're on the subject of wildlife, did you have many other tangles with Vietnamese wildlife, animals, insects? You know, what was
when
like?
I was snakes were an issue. But they had water snakes that were supposedly poisonous, so we couldn't throw guys in on their birthday anymore in the water down south. Because supposedly they could get bit by a snake. And again, we had this tradition of going throwing guys in the water off the bridge on their birthdays. They stopped that because the snakes, I don't know if anybody ever got bit or not, but they just stopped it.
Mm-hmm.
There were supposedly some cobras in the bunker one night with some guys. I wasn't there, but they said that there was a couple of cobras in the bunker and when the rockets went off. But let me tell you something, if you've got a choice between a cobra or a rocket, you will take a cobra every time.
Mm-hmm.
And or a mortar, and nobody got bit or anything. You know, I was in grade registration, and a little bit of time I was there, they had talked about it. They brought a guy in just recently, he'd been killed by a tiger, and when he was on watch one night.
Mm-hmm.
There was just insects were bad over there. I mean, just was it, you know, it was a tropical place. And I heard ants could be a real problem, but I never ran into any of them.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I was a perimeter guy. And I just wasn't out in the bush like those other guys.
Right. Okay. How about leeches?
I heard about them, but I never was stomping through the rice paddies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know if in your river work, if you ever...
No, never saw. I had a problem with that.
Okay. Now, excuse me, the radio traffic and the teletype traffic that you're privy to earlier, when you mentioned that, you know, once in a while you'd hear that someone was being interrogated, someone
mm-hmm.
captured. When you were, did it differentiate what military organization the captured person belonged to, whether it was Viet Cong, NVA, or whatever?
I got the impression it was Viet Cong and not NVA. And that was that, but I don't know that to be the case. Now, you know, an NVA soldier is just a soldier, whereas the Viet Cong probably is some kind of guy with some intelligence, is a general rule, I think. And the interrogator, the actual person that's actually, you know, hurting the person, was a Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure our guys were there on the sidelines, but my understanding was it was. Now, I know this, when I was at Anwar for those few days,
mm-hmm.
they had a guy come by. I saw him with his hands tied behind his back, and he was only had him on a pair of shorts, and he was bloodied on his buttocks, and had a wound there, and it wasn't real bad, but he was hurt, and he was going to interrogation. We watched him go by, and they said he's going to interrogation, and I'm sure he didn't have a very good time, but they said a Viet Cong guy,
mm-hmm.
but that's all I saw.
That's the only prisoner you saw firsthand?
Yes.
Okay.
And I did see him.
Okay. And let's see. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's
okay. Let's see. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to discuss about your time at Sahuan prior to getting injured?
No, not really. That was it was the most interesting thing. And I could, I was called duty to go to it. There was a dump truck. One of our guys ran over some Vietnamese children.
Oh, no.
And, the guy that ran over him was a guy I played poker with on a regular basis, and a guy from Chicago. And he had backed down into this area, this low area, to dump trash. And our trash was Vietnamese treasures. And when he opened up the lid, the kids ran over there and started picking up what was falling out of the trash. And his brakes failed, and he backed up over them. And so I was sent down there real fast. Well, we had a riot on our hand right away. We had the Vietnamese out in the field, and all the civilians came up and were just screaming, and you know, and sure, I mean, all these kids are hurt, you know, and we were doing everything we could. I say we, I mean, I was just standing around. The chief corpsman came over. He had called in a helicopter immediately. And, I mean,
mm-hmm.
we were trying to quiet this riot down. Actually, it was going to get out of hand. We weren't careful,
mm-hmm.
and these people were very angry, and they were screaming and crying. It was very, very emotional. I mean, I'm emotional about thinking about it right now,
mm-hmm.
and.
You want to take a minute?
No. And so this guy said, well, get 45s, and we have to fire in the air and fire over their heads. Well, we did that, and they backed off, but I could just see the hate in those people's eyes. I mean, it was just unbelievable. They were looking at me, and I was just, you know, I was 19 years old, and they hated me. You could see it. And we got a chopper in, and we loaded the kids up, and they were going to send them to Duck Foe. And I know that the one I carried, now, I took a litter and carried this one 15-year-old girl. I know that because I watched the radio message come in that night over to the helicopter. When we're carrying her over there, she flops off of it. I mean, right there on the ground, you know, and she's got internal injuries. And here, you know, we couldn't even carry her to the helicopter for crying out loud. And so I get her back on the stretcher, and the helicopter comes in, and it's blowing dust. I mean, if you've ever been around a helicopter, man, they are miserable when they land next to you. I mean, those things blow dirt unbelievably. They're very, very brutal, you know, wind
mm-hmm.
cranking machines, okay? So, and I looked down, and her eyes were open, and there was dust just hitting her eyeballs, so I could tell she was dead or close to it. And she ended up dying. But that was a very emotional thing. And the guy that ran over him, I felt so sorry for him. I mean, he was a tough kid, and you know, that affected him tremendously. I mean, I could see he was very shook up. Well, we all were. I mean, there was a kid, a little smallest kid, like a three-year-old boy, and I remember one of our guys went over and picked him up, and he just had a huge chunk out of his head. I mean, just a huge. And, you know, kid was really did not appear to be in any kind of shock or anything. He was just kind of looking around, kind of a little dazed. But I think that right there was a lot of the emotion. I felt like we needed to get out of Vietnam. We weren't doing anybody any good over there, man. We needed to get out of there. We were just causing trouble.
My goodness. And how close was this to the engagement where you were injured?
You mean time-wise?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know, 3 weeks,
okay.
A month, maybe.
Okay. Any other incidents stand out in your mind, or any other activities?
No, there was a lot of shooting and everything that I heard on the radios, and that stuff,
yeah.
You know, was you know, I remember it, but I can't say it really stands out.
Yeah. Now, about the support you provided for the Army, you mostly brought in supplies and got them to them, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever any shortages of stuff that you remember?
Yeah. Now, there was a talk of shortages all the time. Mm-hmm. I never had a shortage myself, but I heard a lot of people say that they did. And I remember some Marines talking about how they had to go out in the field with their dress shoes on. Mm-hmm. And again, if you had a shortage, you can go to Black Market and get whatever you wanted. Mm-hmm. But I never saw any shortages, and we never had. There was food shortage, good food shortages. Mm. I mean, we ate out of cans all the time in South Wind, and yeah, I mean, there was no. There was a shortage of decent food, and every now and then some decent stuff would come in. But I heard a lot of shortages. I can't say I was affected by any of them. We had plenty of beer. I remember when they talked about in the very first when we went to Vietnam. To the orientation, the guy, the admiral came out and talked about all the body counts. He said that, this war is pretty much supported by Anheuser-Busch. He said, it used to be we had a six-pack per day, you know, something per man. He said, but now we can honestly say that per man there's 2 cases per day. You know, I remember some absurd number like that. And so anyway, there was never a shortage of beer.
Mm-hmm.
Keep everybody drunk over there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was that an important outlet for you?
Oh yeah, I mean, getting you know, yeah, I mean, to get drunk was you know something that I wasn't the only one, and you know, it just if you could go. Of course, now in South Wind that was different. You didn't want to get too drunk in South Wind. You may have to get them all night and fight your way out of this deal, you know. But in Tinshaw and all that, yeah, if you get some time off, just you know, go get bombed.
And what about other mechanisms of, distraction? USO shows, Army services, stuff like that.
Yeah, they had bands that came in and would play occasionally. They were nice. I mean, they had bands at the clubs that you could go to. In the South Wind, we had one time we had a some kind of band came in, some Australian band. They played. Yeah, that was great.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't much of that, though.
Yeah.
It was very rare and few between.
You didn't see any major USO shows?
No, they had Bob Hope was there when I was there, but I remember them saying, Watson, you've got watch today in airplane, but he went out, and that was the same chief that sent me to South Wind, and I all went down there, and I ended up standing and watch that day. I didn't get to go.
Okay.
I don't really regret it either, particularly.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and discuss the events leading up to your you being injured?
Well, it was just a every now and then we'd have to go to Duck Foe to pick up the mail or whatnot. And I was going to go in the convoy that day, Army convoy, tag along, you know, be part and go down there and pick up the mail or take the and get photos developed or whatever, and just to do pick up stuff and bring back. And so the convoys went every day or went most days, and our guys would just go with somebody in our group would just go down there and come back with whatever we needed to do. So I went that day and. And 12 Mason, that and we'd been hit all that night. We'd had been to the most. We'd been mortared heavier that night than any time I'd been there. And then they quit during the day. And then that afternoon, at 5 o'clock, is when our convoy got hit. As we got, you know, like 3 miles outside of Saigon. South Wind, on going towards Duck Foe. And they just ambushed us, and we had about like 15
vehicle convoy, mm-hmm. mostly carrying carrying a lot of JP-4 fuel, jet fuel, which is what I was in, a tanker, and then they had flatbed trucks carrying artillery shells, and in between each one was either a track, you know, someone carrying a, that was protecting it with a 50 caliber machine gun and hard gun jeep, and it just, they hit us, and that was it.
What size enemy force was it, do you think?
I don't know. They said it must have been a pretty good NVA operation, but I don't know. I really don't know if it was just a couple of company or a couple of squads or anything. I don't know. I never saw any of that. Well, I saw some dead ones, but I didn't see any live ones, really.
About how many men were involved in the convoy?
I'm going to guess 50.
About how many vehicles?
I'm going to guess 50. I don't, I'm sorry?
About how many vehicles?
Well, I'd say 15 to 20, I guess. Would that make sense? Three in each one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess that's about right. And again, I mean, you know, I don't think anybody knows. I mean, this thing probably started out wanting this many, and at the last minute they changed it. I don't know. But I know there was a good long convoy. I know that. And, you know, he had guys in each vehicle, two or three, four guys in each vehicle.
Yeah. How long did the ambush last?
I'm going to guess it lasted 30 or 45 minutes, really. I mean, they immediately took us out of commission. And that was one thing they talked about. We were going to go to a place called Ambush Pass.
Mm-hmm.
And it was known for sniper fire. But it very rarely stopped a convoy, quote-unquote, stopped the convoy. You know, the convoy kept going. It would take the fire, return fire, but keep going. It rarely, they said, got stopped. And this particular day, not only did we get stopped, we were just obliterated. I mean, the trucks were, you know, off the side of the road, burning, never to be used again type thing. It was a big mess. You know, so they really hit us hard that day. I know the truck I was in completely destroyed, and on the way out of there, I saw other trucks that were burning. There were no way they was ever going to roll again.
About how many vehicles were destroyed?
I don't know, but I heard the first truck and the middle truck and our truck, which is the very end, got destroyed, and I saw other, you know, trucks that were, looked like to me, in pretty bad shape, so I'm going to say five or six at least.
Mm-hmm.
I know there were, I think I heard the report, and I'm pretty sure this is in my, that there were seven guys killed.
Wow. So, how many injured?
A bunch. I don't know how many injured, but a lot.
My goodness.
Yeah, there was a bunch of us hit. I talked to one guy later. He said that he was driving in a truck by himself, which is pretty rare. He was driving a deuce and a half. He said he was just driving along. He said he saw some stuff hitting on the side of the road, which turned out to be RPG rounds, which is what I got hit by.
Mm-hmm.
And he said all of a sudden a bullet just went right through his arm.
My goodness.
You know, the one he was holding on the steering wheel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he would, and so he was injured, but he survived it, you know.
Right.
Said he opened up the truck door and jumped out.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the truck just went on down. And it was a very curvy road, just went off the road. To
mm-hmm. Now, how did the men, especially the security element of the convoy, react?
Very well. And they were cranking it, man. I mean, they were doing a good job. In fact, I immediately heard those M60 machine guns, which were on those jeeps, open up. And then when my truck went off the road, and it was, you know, I could hear the AK-47. Well, AK-47 rifle makes a much different sound than an M16. So you can hear and discern the sound of an AK-47. And I could hear those AK-47 shooting over there where my truck was. I was told later there was like 100 rounds shot into that cab of that truck I was at. Now, why they went over there and shot up that truck beyond me, because it was burning.
Mm.
It was out of commission. But that's what I was told. Now, they were over there shooting the truck up because I could hear that AK-47. And so I knew they were in the area, and we were the last guy in the convoy. So there was nobody behind us. And gun jeep security guy, there was three guys? Two guys in a gun jeep were hung around to see if there's anybody going to come out of that smoke, which I did, and they picked me up. And in fact, one guy came out, you know, went in harm's way to come out and get me.
Wow.
And would I like to talk to that guy today? You know, mm-hmm. Who knows who he was? He was an Army guy. I never saw him there again. I never heard his name or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But he went out. He put himself at risk to go out and pull me back, pull me next to the jeep, and then we got in that jeep, took on off. And
mm-hmm.
There was a motorcycle that came up. As we were leaving, there was a motorcycle that was coming towards us on this curvy road, this L-shaped road, and I could see it on the before it made to the curve. So in other words, it was running almost parallel, or a little bit perpendicular. And I could see this thing coming. I said, what in the hell is that? And I could see it was a, like a Honda 90 or something, and this guy was on a motorcycle. And he turned the curve, and he's coming straight at us, and I went, whoa. You know, all of a sudden I looked over, and there was some 50 caliber tracers I could just reach out literally and touched. They went right by us and just hit that guy on that bike, and that turned out to be the track that was behind us that we just passed, and they just, you know, blew that guy to pieces. And,
this was an enemy soldier on a bike.
Well, I don't know who it was.
Oh.
I'm assuming it was, but whoever it was in the wrong place, okay? He shouldn't have been out there riding that motorcycle. But, yeah, I'm assuming he's enemy, and they assumed he was enemy, and he killed him.
My goodness. You didn't notice if he was in uniform?
He was not in uniform, because I noticed him distinctly as we drove by. He was on my side of the Jeep, and we went by him, and he was just, you know, just very dead, and only had been alive just a few seconds earlier. And he was definitely not in uniform. He was a civilian, a tired individual on a civilian-type motorcycle. And why he was in the middle of all that firefight, you know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost one of those things, am I sure I really saw that or not, but I'm pretty sure I did.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say your truck got hit by an RPG, is that correct?
Right.
And you got injured in that first blast?
Right.
Did it throw you from the vehicle? Did you jump out of the vehicle?
No, the RPG hit the vehicle, and again, the road was curvy, and Then we started getting hit by automatic weapons fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I laid down in the deal, and the weapons fire was coming in right above me, and it was hitting the fuel tanker. I could see the bullet holes going into the fuel tanker,
mm-hmm.
and I could see the fuel spilling out. And Baxter, who was driving, had been killed, and I was laying on top of him, his body, and I reached over then at that point because I was dazed. I mean, in fact, I was flat out knocked out at first, and I came to pretty quick, and I reached over to get the steering wheel, and right when that happened, that I realized that we were going off the cliff. And when we did, we had a canvas top in that cab, and it hit, and about 15, 20 feet down, hit and jackknifed, and then I was thrown out through the canvas top of that cab. And I mean, when I went out of that, I mean, I looked up into a blue sky and was just falling, and I just wondered how long I'm not going to fall before I hit ground, because it was a long time, it felt like. And I finally hit the ground, and somebody shot at me again with an RPG, because I heard it go over my head and explode. You know, I heard that boom, and I hit the ground. And then I made it away from the truck because I thought it was going to blow up. It never did. But got over there and got a big rock and lay on the other side of it. And I'd lost my rifle. And I'd even lost my knife. I couldn't even find it. So, I mean, I'd taken a pretty big spill, if you will. I'd lost my wallet. I'd lost my ID card. I'd lost my dog tags. I was... You know, my clothes were really, literally in tatters, you know, from that fall and landing and whatnot.
And you said earlier in our interview yesterday, you mentioned that you were close to being captured?
Well, I mean, I could hear them shooting the place up over on the other side, and they were getting closer. I could tell that, too. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I just a matter of time before I felt like I was going to look over, you know, and see a squad walking towards me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, and I wanted to get up and run, but I was afraid to. As a matter of fact, when I did get up and head for the road, I heard AKs open up again. So, but I got into the smoke and laid down on the road, and they were lower than me, so they couldn't just lay their rifles along the road and you know get somebody laying there. They were at an angle disadvantage. So, I mean, I was laying in the smoke. They couldn't see me inside the smoke, and then they couldn't put their rifles right along the road and fire at me. But I assumed they were shooting at me because, I mean, I heard them open up since I got up on the road. But when I got in smoke and I went on the other side of the smoke, there was the gun Jeep, you know, and I held up my hands because I was afraid they were going to turn around and shoot me, and they signaled me to come to them, and I tried to, but I was hurting pretty bad. My legs were just full of shrapnel, and I fell twice, and that second time that guy ran out and pulled me back.
Mm-hmm. What happened after that?
Well, we got in the gun Jeep. I told him, I've lost my rifle. I said, I need a rifle, and they said, we're out of ammo. And I said, we got to go pick up some ammo, and I said, well, I'd really like a rifle, you know, but I was hurting real bad, and I think they were looking at me with grimaces, you know, and I could tell that by their expressions they thought I was somebody they needed to get to a medevac. So they said, let's get in the Jeep. And we got in the Jeep, and this guy had a 45 in one hand, was shifting gears with a 45 in one hand, steering the other. I mean, literally, we were going so fast, and then we went by the guy with the motorcycle, and we're going by burning trucks that are on fire, literally with ammunition on them, and I thought the thing was going to blow up. And he was driving so fast and dodging bodies and pieces of chunks of burning stuff in the road. I thought we were going to get killed in a Jeep wreck. And the guy on the working those M60 machine gun, was standing up back just firing as fast as he could. I mean, the rounds were falling all over me. And it was quite a ride. And we went through all of that and got away from it down the road. And someplace we pulled up next to what they call a track. It was the M119s or whatever they are. They're a track, but they're an armored personnel carrier. Mm-hmm. But this one didn't have any personnel, and it had a guy on top with a machine gun. And they stopped and opened up the back door and put me in it, which there was a medic in there. And then they went and got pulled out a whole bunch of boxes of ammunition and got back in the Jeep and headed back right into it. Those are some incredible guys, I'll tell you. Mm-hmm. And that was, to answer your question about the security guys, that was who they were doing that. And, boy, they unloaded me. One guy put himself at risk to get me, unloaded me, you know, loaded back up with ammunition, took off and got back into it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a tremendous display of courage, mm-hmm, and duty. I was in awe. And once I was in the track, though, the medic, you know, started kind of looking me over and said basically they were going to get me to a dust off and get me out of there. And I said, okay.
Mm-hmm. How long did that take?
I'm going to guess 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. I remember riding in the Jeep, and I remember kind of dozing in and out. And I think the guy gave me some morphine, but I cannot remember that exactly. I don't know why I would have dozed in and out, though, had I not had morphine. But I don't remember him giving me a shot or anything. And I remember being very thirsty, and there was beer cans all over the that track, mm-hmm, and rolling around, empty beer cans. And the guy ended up shooting the machine gun at a beer can between his legs. Mm-hmm. And he had about half the teeth he should have had in his head, and he had tattoos all up down his arm. And he was just shooting that machine gun like he was having the most fun he ever had in his life. But they took me there, and then they took me out, got me out of that, and then I saw some guys running with all four parts of the litter, and then the next thing I knew, the helicopter blades were spinning above me, and the next thing I knew, I was lifted out of there.
Mm-hmm. And this was May of 69, correct?
Correct, yeah. Just before dark.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, where were you taken in terms of the hospital?
I was taken to Duck Foe first, which was kind of just like a MASH unit, only a modern-day one. And they landed and pulled me off of it, took me inside, tore all my clothes off, mm-hmm, in a very quick fashion, inserted a catheter in my penis because I had a wound in my penis. Mm-hmm. A lot of other places too. They had one there, so they put a catheter in. They put an IV in me. They cleaned off the wounds as best as possible. Put some on the bigger wounds. They put some bandages and took me out, put me down, and waited for the next helicopter that's going to go to Chulai. Mm-hmm. And so from there on out, I didn't have any clothes on. They just had a blanket over me, and would. Yeah, and then I went to Chulai, and they started taking the shrapnel out at there, I believe it was. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I underwent kind of surgery there. Mm-hmm. I've heard this before, and it's true. I mean, I was wounded pretty badly. I felt like I was going to live, but I knew I'd been hurt. And I didn't know how bad internally, but as it turned out, I had not been hurt that bad. But I was bleeding. I know I was bleeding very badly, but there's always somebody worse off. I'd heard that, and that was true. We had a black guy, and he was somewhere in the convoy. I don't know where, but he and I rode together in every way. I mean, they loaded us up the first helicopter. He put us on the second helicopter at Chulai. And he had a head wound. And he had also some wounds that were real close to his abdomen in his hip area. And anyway, when they had our clothes off and we were at Chulai, and this is after quite a bit of helicopter riding and after quite a bit of stuff, and this took an hour and a half, maybe, I don't know, an hour and a half, hour or whatever, later, I looked over and they were literally cutting just a little bit of flesh to his left and his up and around his hip that held his entire leg. And as they were, one guy was holding his entire leg up, the other guy was just literally cutting away what little flesh was left. And this guy was looking up and was watching them do this, and then immediately started moaning. And when the doctor saw that this guy was awake and was watching this, just grabbed his forehead and pulled his head down. You know, it made my wounds feel pretty insignificant at that point.
You want to take a minute?
No. So anyway, that guy was, well, I don't know if he made it or not, but they put us together again for another helicopter flight. Mm-hmm. I remember the medic on board that flight kept reaching over and touching his jugular vein, I guess, to see if he was still alive. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if that guy ever made it. But I remember that kind of humorous, I guess. Before we actually got picked up on the by the first helicopter, I was laying out next to this track, and they'd stopped, and there was a squad of guys, and they were all pulling out their cigarette packages and offering me a cigarette, you know. I, of course, I didn't smoke, which was a rarity. I heard the sergeant, whoever was on the in charge, going, "We need to get a chopper. We need to get a dust off in here right now." He said, "I've got one that may die on me." I didn't know, maybe he wasn't talking about me, you know, but he was talking about that black guy.
Yeah.
So.
My goodness.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
Now, did you? How long was your convalescence?
Let's see. I was. I ended up leaving Vietnam as soon as I could walk, which was 3 days later, May 15th. And I couldn't walk very good, but I could walk. I could literally get up and go to the bathroom.
Okay.
But I left May 15th of 69, mm-hmm. and then I went to Japan, Yokosuka, mm-hmm. Japan, and I was there, and there was another hospital. I was in three hospitals in Japan. And I got home, and I went to a hospital in Alaska for a couple of days, and I was in the hospital in Memphis, which I stayed for a while. And then at that point, though, I was home, I guess, 3 weeks later.
Mm-hmm. So you never went back to Vietnam?
No, I was out of there. In fact, that night when they took me to the hospital in Chulai, they got me in bed like at midnight, and the guy came over and he said, "We're going to put you in this bed." And he goes, "You know what's about this bed?" And I said, "What's about this bed?" He said, "Anybody gets in this bed goes home."
Hmm.
So I knew I was out of Vietnam. In fact, the medic inside the track mm-hmm. said, "You're out of here, buddy." He said, "You're going home."
Wow.
And I guess they could just tell the severity of my wounds was that, you know, there was no way I was going to be back to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of, because I had 4 months left to go in Vietnam, and I thought, mm-hmm. was it 4 months? Yeah, 4 months left to go in Vietnam, and mm-hmm. all of a sudden, boom, I'm out of there, which yeah. was, I never did have that countdown, you know, like yeah. everybody else did.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, one day, I'm out of Vietnam.
Wow. How did you feel about that?
Well, I was glad to be back. I kind of regret today, to this day, not having that countdown, though, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been fun to have gotten on that plane, you know, at the last day of your tour. But I was glad to get out of Vietnam. Glad to see my folks, get home, see my girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. How long was it until you're back to normal? Completely recovered from your injuries.
Well, I never did really fully recover. When you stay, you know, talk about hearing, because I can't hear on my left ear right today. I wear a hearing aid the VA gave me, and I limped for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and then later I had a major knee surgery
mm-hmm.
Because they say, or some doctors say no,
mm-hmm.
because of that injury. And to this day, I can't bend that knee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as I should be able to bend it, even though it doesn't hurt me. I mean, it doesn't cause me a problem. I ride a bicycle during it.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then I was on permanent limited duty for the rest of the time I was in the Navy. I didn't have to stand inspections where I stood up a long time. I was precluded from high-intensity noises,
mm-hmm.
that type of thing.
Okay. Now, were you discharged from the military once you got back home? Once you got back home?
No, I had to spend spent the next 2 years in the Navy under what they call limited duty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was doing a desk job there in a radio station, so
mm-hmm.
I mean, I could do that work.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not qualified for reenlistment, as I remember it.
Because of your injuries?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, basically, you didn't get out of the Navy until 71.
That's correct.
The time that you were in, did you have a lot of interaction with other Vietnam veterans who were Navy? In the Navy?
No, not at all. I mean, there weren't. When I got into the, actually got back, now 2 years, and what is it now? I've been in the Navy 2.5 years or whatever, and all of a sudden I'm in where I should have been in the very beginning if I'd gone, everything gone according to oil.
Mm-hmm.
At this Naval Air Station in Beeville, Texas, and all of a sudden the chief there and everything was kind of disgusted. He says, "You mean they sent me somebody that doesn't know anything about about naval communications?" I said, "Hey, man, I've been in Vietnam. I didn't want to go over there." He said, "Well, you know, you're not going to do us any good. I mean, you don't know anything about this stuff." And I said, "No, I haven't been on a ship, Chief. I haven't. I've been in Vietnam. And the reason I'm here is because there's a naval air station, I mean, a naval hospital just down the road. I'm going to continue having surgery," which I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to periodically go down there and get some more surgery done on my ear and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these guys now, they've been 2.5 years out in the fleet, and they knew all about naval communications. I didn't know anything, because I had, you know, so I had to kind of get up to speed. I remember the chief being a little bit irritated by that,
yeah.
But, you know, I was back into what I should have been doing all along, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And there, as far as any Vietnam veterans, no.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of guys that had spent some time what they call Yankee Station, which was the fleet right outside of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But they were on ships. And I was pretty decorated to this point. I mean, most of these guys just had one or two ribbons. I had a bunch, and I got some accolades for that. I got some esteem from that.
Mm-hmm.
It's on right. And the CO was from Dallas, and I would take messages up there because he was in the same building I was. And, you know, I converse with him occasionally, and if anybody got an outstanding in an inspection, which I didn't have to stand inspections, but if anybody got an outstanding in inspection, they got a day off. Well, you know, that CO from Dallas would come up to me in the inspection ranks because I'd go ahead and go, and he'd look at me and go, "Watson, outstanding,"
mm-hmm.
which is basically giving me a day off.
You know? Mm-hmm.
And of course, that was a little bit of an irritant to my chief, but he knew what the politics were. So.
Yeah.
But anyway, bottom line is that I did get some. You know, I was going to back and forth to the hospital, getting my wounds treated at the Naval Hospital. I even had to go and stay for 3 weeks or whatever. And I was decorated, and that meant something in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Okay. Now, I'm curious. I didn't ask you this earlier, and I should have. What was the difference between the communications work you did, say, at the White Elephant and whatnot, versus the crypto teletype communication that you did down at Southland?
You know, there wasn't. The crypto communication itself was a, how was that? There probably wasn't that much difference. Now, I didn't, when I was at the White Elephant, they didn't let me go in and change up the wires on the crypto.
Mm.
I didn't get to open the envelope. Down at Southland, I was, I made a third class, I was E4, now they were letting me do stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference was basically, I guess, was number one, there was just the one radio, the one crypto unit down at Southwind, and it was, by the way, the only air-conditioned place on that place because it had to be kept cool.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a little van-type place. You're just sitting offside, and you open the door and go inside. It was cool, and that was where you did the crypto stuff. Now, they had the same thing at the White Elephant, except that they didn't let me do that at the White Elephant. Now, down at Southwind, I was one of the group, a few guys radio in, and they let me do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had a job every now and then. I had to go in and change the wires up. As I remember, we pulled out little pegs and put them in holes, and that's how you, based on this thing you pulled out of the envelope, that's how you set the code for that day.
Okay.
Now, the transmission, I'm sitting here thinking to myself, I don't remember we had a teletype. But then again, I remember, yes, we must have had a teletype in there. Most of what we did was voice, because now I remember reading off print about that incident with the truck running over those kids. I remember that night getting the deal. I remember reading the names of those people. They were all Vietnamese. But,
mm-hmm.
And also I remember them saying they were going to pay some remuneration to the next of kin. So I was reading that, not hearing it. So we had a van with a teletype and the crypto stuff there at Southwind. And it was probably the same system they had at White Elephant, just smaller and only one of them.
Yeah. Not to be morbid, but in that incident with the truck, how many kids were killed?
One. Because I remember there was one kid, but boy, there was some of them messed up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who knows how many of them are in a wheelchair today. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know, it went over them, you know, it just crushed them.
Right.
But it didn't, there was one, as far as I know, killed, that 15-year-old girl.
Yeah. How many were injured?
I'm going to guess 6 or 7 or 8.
Okay. Let's go ahead and continue with our discussion of your time back in the United States. When you got back, were you at all surprised at what was going on in the U.S. in late 69 and early 70?
Well, what happened was I came back, and I had a lot of friends, that were saying, hey, I was the only guy, and I had a lot of friends, and I was pretty popular in school. So when I came back, immediately, my buddies got together and said, hey, and their girlfriends, who I'd never not met, they'd all made new girlfriends since I'd left, were getting me dates. I was very popular. So on the standpoint of a social life, I had a great one when I got back. I mean, Phil's back in Vietnam here, what's her name, will get you a date with me. They would get me dates with girls that would never go out with me otherwise. Their girlfriends were getting me the dates. So I was enjoying a real nice social life, but I was also, at the same time, a little upset that they weren't more, you know, outraged about the Vietnam War. And, you know, they'd been to some protests, they said, they, you know, this and that. But still, they were more concerned with their parties and racing maybe their cars a little bit or other things. And I was thinking, hey, guys, you know, there's a war going on here, people getting killed, and why are y'all involved? And immediately, I think I was told later that I was considered to be a little bit of a head case. So it fit right in. It fit right in with the old stereotypical mold of a crazy Vietnam veteran, which I don't think I was a head case. I thought I was pretty serious about getting this stupid war stopped, you know. Well, I got in an early out of the Navy, like 3 months just to get into college. So I was going to, I went over there and got enrolled at North Texas, and I was going to spend one semester there and go down to UT. Mm-hmm. But all my friends were at North Texas and had all gone to Tech and UT and wherever else and flunked out, and we're now all congregated in North Texas, and we're, you know, juniors and trying to get, you know, the time wasted that they'd made mistakes, even though they hadn't gone to the military, together. And so we all kind of got back together up there. But I was still a little irritated, so I got in with a little bit more of the political-oriented group there in school, which was the VVAW and some of the other protest groups. And didn't get real radical, but I did get involved enough to where I thought, like, we ought to do some protesting. We ought to, you know, write some letters and carry on, you know, trying to get the war stopped. Mm-hmm. But it was winding down, and the fervor and the passion and whatnot just wasn't there. I mean, we could tell we were moving out of that war. And so, you know, just at this point, it was just going to wind itself down no matter what we did. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, there just wasn't there just as far as pushing it and going down and doing a lot of protesting or whatnot. So I just wrote letters and did stuff like that, just tried to get my life back in order. Mm-hmm. But I was surprised when I got back that, you know, people weren't more outraged about it. Mm-hmm. My brother was very involved with busing at the time. Busing was a big deal, and that seemed to be really had a lot of people's attention. You know, this busing thing, they were all upset about that. That seemed to be the political issue at the moment, not Vietnam.
Now, what do you mean busing?
Yeah, busing came out, it was an integration thing, you know, like, if you have all whites in one neighborhood, mm-hmm. you're not going to have any blacks in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So what they did was people would get on a bus, kids would get on a bus 30 miles away, and mm-hmm. the whites would go down to South Dallas, and South Dallas kids would go to North Dallas, and that was called busing. Mm-hmm. And it had a lot of an emotional content to it, because people didn't want to put their kids on a bus to go 30 miles to go in a school to be with blacks when they could go two blocks over and go to school with their neighborhood kids. Mm-hmm. Well, you can see where that was an emotional issue, and that was going on. Busing was a big deal, and I guess it's making me feel really old to hear you go, now, what's with this busing?
No, I was asking for clarification. I knew what it was. I just wanted to make sure that we got it on the record.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
That's okay. The integration issue is an interesting one from the standpoint of just the nation's, what was going on in the nation generally. What did you think about that personally?
Busing?
Did you think that integration was necessary?
Yeah. I mean, I felt like that was going to work itself out. I didn't see that as something was killing people.
Right.
I didn't see that as something was, obviously there had been some bombings in 64 or whatever and all that kind of stuff. People had been hurt, but I felt like that was pretty much the worst was over and it was going to work itself out.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that as just a social issue that was going to have its a good outcome at the end. I saw Vietnam was totally different.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that Vietnam was something we needed to beat it to death. It needed to end. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it was just a waste of human life. You know, I'll tell you something right now. A dead teenage boy is a very ugly thing. And I'm going to tell you right now, it is a very ugly thing. I told him, I said, we can stop this war tonight. All we have to do is parade people through grave registration, and it'll stop. And that's the problem is that people hadn't seen what I'd seen. And I was, again, against the war going in. And boy, now I was really, you know, emotional about it.
Mm-hmm.
But
when did you become involved with the Vietnam Veterans Against the War?
Well, I was at North Texas State, and they had a chapter up there. And they had right there next to all the fraternities, there was the table for the Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
Mm-hmm.
So I just went over, and I could tell those guys a little older than the other students. And there was a lot of veterans, boy. I mean, going to school, because G.I. Bill and mm-hmm. guys would come back, and in fact, there was a lot of veterans on campus. You could see the, you know, they were wearing their greens, they were wearing their insignias that they had when they were in the military.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were wearing their flop hats, their rain hats. There were, you know, there was just a lot of it there. And so I went over to their table and said, "Hey guys, you know, how do I get some? You know, how do we get going on this deal?" They said, "Well, we got a protest coming up in Houston this weekend. You know, if you want to go to that." So just kind of touched base with those guys. But again, it was the fervor and the passion was not there anymore.
For
you know, for really getting out and making your voice heard. I mean, you know, they go ahead, the protests were dwindling because the war was in fact winding down. You could see it happening.
And, of course, at this point, the draft issue.
Yeah, that Nixon's what stopped it in 73. But also, I think in 71, 72, you didn't have as many being. I don't think the people were being drafted like they were. I think that there was a. It was more of a professional slant towards the war. You know, I think there was less of the populace being forced into it. It was being taken on by their career. I think that's what happened. I know that nobody, I can tell you that being my age, I'm one of the youngest to get processed through on that system, through the draft.
Yeah.
One of the very youngest. I mean, most people, I've talked to people before, and they said, "Well, you're too young to be a Vietnam vet." And I said, "Yeah." I said, but I was. I said, "But I was one of the last ones."
Now, when you became involved with the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, what did your dad know? Did your family know you were becoming?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I went to. That's an interesting point. I went to was going to go to Houston one weekend for a big demonstration. There was supposed to be a big one going on. And my dad. Oh, and somebody called over at my house, one of the VVA guys, and said, "Hey, this is so and so, the VVAW, and we're just trying to get in touch with Phil. He's supposed to go to Houston with us this weekend." Well, my dad said, "Well, I'll take your name and number," and he did. And then he told me flat out, said, "You're not going down there. You're not going down there and do that protest." And I said, "Well, you know," then that was the beginning of the agitation. I said, "Hey, I've been to Vietnam, you know." And he said, "I don't give a damn, you know, if you have or not. You're not living in this house and going down there protesting against the war." You know, and it was that top deal. And all of a sudden there was a lot of, you know, my brother was like, "Hey, you know, the war is coming to an end. We got this busing issue." And, you know, they were saying, "Look, you need to rearrange your priorities here. You know, your efforts need to be put into more, you know, better use or whatever." So there was some irritation, you know. My parents didn't like it one bit.
Did you go anyway?
I was going to go. That was another thing. I was going to go that weekend. There was a few of us that were going to go in one car, and the rest of them went on. And the ones that were going to go in this one car, all of a sudden the guy that has the car, at the last minute, starts having these reservations, and there was almost a bad fist fight between a couple of the guys in the group because the guy with the car was not going to, was backing out the last minute when everybody else had already gone. So we did not go that weekend, but there was a lot of ill feeling between us and that element of Vietnam veterans. And those were all Army guys, too. I was there, again, I was being Navy, I was the only Navy Vietnam veteran. I mean, I think the rest of all of them were Army. You know, all of them were draftees. But I remember not going that weekend, and I remember just being very angry at that guy that had the car. And so the next Monday, I was in class, and I was talking to the guy. I said, how'd it go down there this weekend? Well, the guy said, "Well, you know, you didn't really miss anything because we went down there, and just there wasn't much going on." He said, "There was nobody yelling at us. There was no cops even around to stop us from doing anything." Nobody was, you know, nobody was flipping us off. Or he said, basically, it was pretty much a bust. He said, "You really didn't miss anything." And I can remember then going, "Well, I guess this thing is going away."
Mm-hmm. Did you go to any anti-war demonstrations?
During the campaign of 72, there were politicians that showed up on campus and in Dallas and places and spoke, and I'd go to those, and in that group I would jeer at the people that were that were pro Nixon, and you know, and I'd carry a sign here too, maybe we would just yell at the people, you know. It didn't amount to much, let's put it that way. Even though I would go to these speeches and whatnot and get their opinions and you know, that type of deal.
Now, and this was the election of 72, which is again, you had a clash with your family about.
Right. Yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, I've talked, and my wife voted for Nixon, okay, in 72. Now, I've told people, I said, if you voted for Nixon for 72, then you got blood on your hands, because Nixon was for killing, McGovern was for stopping the killing. Bottom line, there's no, it's cut and dried, it's black and white. And I said, if you voted for Nixon in 72, you have killed people. You have done it through your vote. And well, they disagreed with me. But my father died in December of 72. No, it was 72, yeah. December 72. Yeah, he died. That's right. At the end of 72, he died. Unexpectedly, somewhat unexpectedly. He was in somewhat bad health, but he died of a heart attack. And I can tell you, this is crazy to say this, but my suffering for his death was somewhat mitigated due to the fact that he had voted for Nixon in 72.
Wow.
I mean, I felt that strongly. And he and I had gotten so sideways, you know, and he was somewhat of a, I guess it could have been a, kind of a political. Well, he was political. He talked about it a lot. He was involved politically. He wasn't involved, but he kept up with it, had opinions about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I just, you know, I remember him dying, and I remember thinking that, you know, I could be a lot sadder if my dad hadn't voted for Nixon in 72.
Mm-hmm.
And when my wife and I first got married, I mean, it was a source of contention then.
Wow.
I said, how could you vote for Nixon? I mean, look at the facts. Look at this. Look at that. And,
and she stayed with you anyway.
Yes, they were. We don't have those arguments much anymore. But I was I just couldn't believe it. I mean, Nixon was going to continue the war. He had continued the war. He was going into Cambodia. He was going into Laos. And here was McGovern saying he was going to stop the war, stop it the day he got inaugurated.
Right.
And there was a landslide. It was 50-0 on the states. McGovern didn't even carry his South Dakota.
Right. But Yeah.
I think that's where he's from.
Right. At the same time, you know, Nixon was reelected in 72.
Right.
You have the Christmas bombing campaign in 1972, and the Paris Peace Accords were signed in January 73. The U.S. is pulled out.
Okay, well, you can't see that. You can't see that going into the election.
Right.
I mean, Nixon, I agree with you, okay, but you're looking at, you got the, you know, the hindsight
factor.
Okay,
absolutely.
And,
I mean, after the fact.
Yeah, but Nixon had said he was going to do that in 68.
Yeah.
And, you know, he drug it on for 4 years.
Right.
And that was the argument. He's drugged this thing on for 4 years when he said he was going to do that back in 68.
Yeah.
So who's to say he's going to do it again?
Well, what did you think in January 73 when the Paris Peace Accords were signed, the U.S. was officially out?
Well, I was glad. You know, and then when it finally fell,
yeah.
I mean, I knew that was inevitable. Look, there was never a doubt in my mind we weren't going to achieve what we were trying to do over there. And there was no doubt in my mind whatsoever once I got over there and saw it. And so I just knew that that was not going to come to any good end. I just knew that that was a big mistake. And I can honestly say it, that's the way it turned out. Now, and then Watergate happened. And let me tell you, you want to talk about reveling in it or wallowing in it.
Mm.
That was the terminology, I think, one of the elderly Roosevelt women said to Nixon.
Mm.
And I literally wallowed in that. I watched Watergate, and I didn't even have time to watch it. I watched it at night, and I watched the reruns. During the day, I watched the reruns at night whenever I could.
Mm.
I saw Nixon going down. I was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Mm.
Was when Nixon got effectively in peace or kicked out of office. Because he, on another topic, but he deserved it. And then when Nixon died, which is not too long ago, I took the headlines and I framed it of the Dallas Morning News. Because
mm-hmm.
I was a sick puppy, but I tell you, I thought Nixon was evil, and I still do to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote him letters. I never wrote back, but I did.
Mm-hmm.
Because that guy was, you know, he killed a lot of people, let's face it. And now, again, okay, with hindsight, you're exactly right. The things did end, and people have told me, too, and compassion people that I know,
mm-hmm.
they've told me, said, Philip, they didn't want to just pull the plug like McGovern was talking,
mm-hmm.
because that would have disgraced what you did in Vietnam and all your buddies.
Mm-hmm.
They said, that would have been wrong towards you more than what Nixon did, you know, and I believe what they're saying. I mean, I couldn't see anything but the stopping of the killing. And that's one thing I can agree with Jane Fonda. I mean, she said the same thing. She said, I just wanted the killing stopped. And that's what I did. I wanted the killing stopped.
Yeah.
You know, it was ugly.
Yeah. Well, what did you think when the U.S., I mean, now we're not talking about U.S. Men being in harm's way. We're just talking about the U.S. government providing material support to the South Vietnamese government. That was yanked, and of course, April 75, South Vietnam fell. What did you think when that happened?
Well,
and the decision not to provide just material support.
Well, I mean, civil wars are part of the human experience, our civilization.
Right.
That was a civil war. We had a civil war over here. There have been civil wars everywhere. Civil wars, I mean, they wanted to reunite their country, and the people that wanted to reunite it were stronger and more focused in their efforts than the people that did not want to unite it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, democracy versus communism, you know, we've got a philosophical argument there.
Mm-hmm.
But and I believe democracy would be better than communism, but bottom line, there was a civil war. Now, yeah, they say, oh, domino theory and all that crap, and I think it has some merit, but civil wars happen. You know, I mean, people get, that just happened. We had our civil war. It was horribly bloody, but it settled itself, and, you know, the country's better afterwards. And I think that's just what they were going through, a civil war. We should have stayed out of it.
Okay. Well, what do you think about deployments of American forces today?
Well, I think we need to do it occasionally, you know, and strategically.
Mm-hmm.
There's times when you have to do things like that, but you got to be careful in this nation-building thing.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously those atrocities that were going on over in Bosnia, that were very, you know, wrenching. I mean, just terrible things were going on over there. But I think it can be done correctly. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was done incorrectly. And I think they probably learned from it in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we're a great country. We've got a lot of technology. We've got a lot of firepower. We can be careful. But if you make the world a better place, you can help out. And yeah, go for it. But you know, you're gonna have to go in with your eyes open and not just come out with some macho stuff like Westmoreland was trying to do
mm-hmm.
with his air cavalry. And he thought he had all. You know, those guys miscalculated. Miscalculated.
How do you feel about your service in Vietnam today?
I'm proud of the way I handle myself, and I did go through some tough stuff, and I did handle it pretty well, and I'm proud of the people I served with. But I feel like I was involved with an illegal activity. I mean, I feel like I was over there doing a wrong thing. Don't think we should have been there, and I don't think, you know, I think I probably, you know, I feel like that the government will never sneak up on me again, you know, that, you know, they fooled me once, they won't fool me twice. I feel like that was just a, I'm, again, on a personal, on a macro level, I'm real happy. On a macro level, I'm unhappy.
Mm-hmm. What did you take away personally from your experience that was important to you, you know, maybe as a life's lesson?
Oh, well, it was, I learned that things can go wrong very quickly, and you better pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can, quickly things can change. And, boy, if you don't watch it and not getting all the information you can get, and you're not prepared, you know, if you're not listening, if you're not paying, you know, things can happen very quickly to your detriment. So you better pay attention. And I did come out of that with that opinion. And I also learned that, you know, that some people are more capable than others. It's just a fact of life. And I don't know. I that's a very mixed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't. I'm proud in some ways. In some ways, I'm disheartened.
Mm-hmm. What do you think we should take away from the war as a nation?
Well, I think we should never just trust our leaders. I think our leaders need to be taken to task when they're going to make big decisions. They need to be told, you know, let them know, we're watching you. You better be making the correct decision as best as you can and not lying to us. And I think that lesson was learned. We were lied to in Vietnam. We're just flat lied to. And, starting from the Gulf of Tonkin experience on forward. And, they got away with it for a long time. People trusted them too much. This is what it comes right down to. I'm irritated at how cavalier people are today about how, oh, well, if I'd have been of your age, I wouldn't have gone to Vietnam. I'd have done this. I'd have done that. Well, you know, Bill Clinton had all the corruption of Arkansas to get him out of the draft, and he had a tough time doing it.
Mm.
But he managed to do it. But he had to, I followed the history of him and his ability to get out of the draft, and he had a tough time. He was right there in that age group that was really getting drafted. He was like 3 years ahead of me. And there was no, and he had to really intimidate the draft board through his, you know, politics, and do a lot of stuff. So it wasn't even easy for him. So, you know, how easy would it have been for somebody else? But I heard all these people all the time go, you know, if I'd have been a guy that age, there's no way I'd have gone. I'd have gone to Canada. I'd have done this. Well, you know, those are all easy things for you to say. But, you know, Canada takes money to live there. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to get a job. You have to have skills to get a job. It's not that easy from Texas just to go to Canada. And I don't know anybody that did. People going to Canada were up there in the Northeast. They lived up there in the Northeast. You know, it's just, I don't know. What bothers me is that people are so cavalier, so easy. Oh, it's such an easy thing to do, to get out of. And it might have been, but I didn't see other people find it that easy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I didn't answer your question, did I?
Yeah, you did. Well, is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
No, sir, I don't think so. That was but I enjoyed it very much.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate you providing the forum.
Oh, well, let me go ahead and put an official ending on the interview real quick. This will end the interview with Mr. Philip Watson. Thank you very much, sir.